And welcome everyone to a brand new episode of the DKP here at WrestlingObserver.com and F4WOnline.com. I am, of course, as always, your host, Alan, and this is the first in a series of shows to debut here on the DKP that, like the Galaxy Chocolate Bar, I'm calling it DKP Duos, because what I aim to do is bring together duos of people from wrestling podcasting, wrestling writing, the wrestling interwebs, who have never been on air with each other before, maybe don't even cross the same circles as each other, but who I believe would make for a fine panel here on the DKP. And I'm starting off with two big guns. I'm starting off with the top of the class. I'm starting off with the two men that I feel are the two most compelling men in pro wrestling audio. I've got Mr. Joe Lanza, the King of Banter himself, and I've got my man here at the F4W Online, the man holding it down daily on the Wrestling Observer Live, Big Mike, Mike Sempervivi. Joe, meet Mike. Mike, meet Joe. Listeners, meet Mike and Joe. How'd you like that for an intro, guys?
That was a pretty good intro. I'm glad that you said that I wasn't the late last-minute replacement for Carl Stern, who you'd planned to have on.
Carl Stern is always my number one choice for a guest on any show, but he seems to always have a meth lab that he needs to break down and charge into and just put fools on their stomach and put some handcuffs on their back.
Which is also why Joe's on the show and not Rich.
Rich is going into meth labs for different reasons. Joe, Rich seems the innocent guy, but do you think there could be some? Do you think there could be some meth involved in the secretly sassy life of Rich Critch?
I don't know about meth, but let me tell you something. And I always try to tell people this: he plays the good cop on the air. This guy's a wild man behind the scenes. Okay, it's a nonstop stream of burials and just throwing people under the bus, but he lets me be the bad guy on the air, which I'm fine with. I'll accept the role, but let me tell you something. Never trust secretly sassy Rich Critch, because I don't give him that nickname. I don't just throw that out there. He really is secretly sassy. You got to watch that guy.
You certainly do. But guys, I'm very happy to bring you together here. We've got a few things in mind that we're going to talk about. But honestly, as I said to you before we start recording, I think we could have just loaded up the recorder, the three of us, and just gone. And we would have been like 4 hours deep on this thing, and it would have just flown by. I'm looking forward to talking to pro wrestling with you guys. You guys have kind of traveled in different circles over the years, but I'm talking to two long-term, long-time, ardent pro wrestling fans right here with a lot of history.
I'd like to think so, and hopefully it just doesn't have to do because of our ages. We've actually kind of done a little bit, dabbled here and there, certainly in the podcasting or radio show realm, however you want to view it. I guess I have been around for a little bit now. Just saw a tweet a little while ago that Paul Fontaine sent out about Mike Coughlin and I being on the first Figure Four Daily that actually had two guests on there, and that was 2007. And
oh, really?
Yeah, and I did Josh Nason's show for the site a couple weeks ago, and he was kind of talking it. It's like, it really, I don't think about it much, but then when I do something like that where it's, I'm reminded that the PPH was a long time ago, and it predated a lot of stuff, and it was a bridge for, I guess, a lot of people, because I don't know how many other wrestling shows were out there. I know there were a handful of them here and there, but you know, from the IATA Observer show, as far as being a bridge to what we have today, the PPH filled that. It still kind of blows my mind.
You know, I think it was the only that I know of. It was the only show that wasn't like on a radio broadcast station.
Yeah, there wasn't an over the air, which, you know, and almost all of those shows are, you know, is the Ultimate Warrior dead? I heard there was, you know, those types of questions on shows and things like that.
Do you guys remember Get in the Ring with the Phantom?
You know, I don't think I ever listened to it.
The Phantom and I think Adam something. That was the one that I remember. And it was like it was definitely on a, and there was no one like, I think Monday Night Mayhem or something like that. There was two, but I think there was a few others that were like on actual radio channels. But as far as something you literally just a right click, save as, download on the internet, the PPH was the only one. And then Joe versus the World came along.
Yeah.
And then here we are 10 years later and everyone has a podcast. Everyone, even me.
Who started listening to the PPH. That's what blows me away more than anything, where it was like, I remember a couple years ago, I kind of lamented. It was like, man, you know, who listened? Because it's like we, Adam and I have now been on the F4W site for 10 years. I mean, we started, I think it was it the beginning of 05? It may have been the beginning of 06 that we started on there. Yeah. So I guess, it was been 10 years that we've been on there and we did the PPH. What, you know, there was a couple years, 3 years before that started up with Keith, Zach Arnold and I. And, you know, I kind of was like, man, I wonder who actually heard those shows. And then to find out a lot of people actually heard those shows, it's very humbling. It kind of just blew me away. And it's like, I have been doing this a long time and I should have more money out of it.
And Joe, when you've talked about this numerous times on your show, one of the things which you feel really helped you guys kind of get to the next level was embracing New Japan, right? As the New Japan boom happened in, I'd say, 2012. And, just kind of riding that wave and seeing that coming, that was the big thing to jump off it. And Mike, you're obviously a huge New Japan fan. True to dark times, you were a big New Japan fan, and it must be gratifying for you to see where they've come. And Joe, to bring it back to you, I think you guys probably feel, would grateful be the word for New Japan, for just how it really took off and how they've handled their business, because it really gave you guys something to latch onto and grow what you guys are doing, but also have something really kind of inspiring to talk about in a positive way, because I'm sure that kind of fuels you and refuels you to do the 3-hour marathon flagship every week.
The timing of all of it was just perfect, because I think we did our first show a week after that Wrestle Kingdom show, where Okada had returned and had that awful match against Yoshihashi, and then challenged Tanahashi at the end of the show. And the following month, of course, was New Beginning with the big upset, and then away we go. And like I've told many times on our show, I mean, I told Rich, I'm like, look, we got to get ahead of this. We've got to jump on this. There's an opportunity here. You know, we were nothing at that point. Our first show, 6 people listened to it, literally 6 people. And I do think that as New Japan grew, we grew, and we focused on New Japan, and we really got lucky, because if New Japan didn't catch on, it would have taken us, you know, twice as long to catch on as a site, as a show, and everything else. But yeah, absolutely. We grew as New Japan grew. Now, the rub to that is, you know, there's a positive and a negative to everything. The positive is New Japan helped us grow. The negative is there's sort of this stigma, I guess you would say, or this reputation we have of being like New Japan cheerleaders. Now, you know, we're not going to be disingenuous on the air. If I'm into something, I'm going to be into it. You know that, Alan. And I'm going to go full ahead with it and be super enthusiastic. And it's just been, you know, an excellent product for the last 4 years. And it has continued to grow. And, you know, if that's the reputation we're going to have, that's fine. You just got to live with that as part of the deal. But yeah, we got very lucky in that the rise of New Japan out of those dark days was sort of coincided with, the rise of our show.
I think, too, this is from the outside looking in, too. It was at a time, and I could be wrong about this. I'm not saying that anybody got tired with the Figure Four site or anything like that, but there is a certain business model that the site has. Even Adam and I show has never exactly fit into that. It's not like Brian and Vinny on those early shows when we were the only other show were on there. We're going, hey, check these guys out about Japan. I mean, the tagline that Adam and I used for so long was just, you know, there's nothing happening in Japan. And I can't remember if Dave or Brian actually gets credit for that quote, but it's...
It was Brian. That was definitely a Brian line that we all took exception to.
A Brian one. And, you know, independent wrestling is not per se as important on the figure four side. Again, it's a different business model. It's not nothing against that business model or anything like that. But there's there was a hole lacking for somebody to truly fill it, because there are a lot of people out there. It was like, it's like the Georgia wrestling scene. There's a ton of different indie promotions out there, but it's like, you know, somebody needs to fill in this hole here. And I think Voices of Wrestling did that for anybody that was disenfranchised with our site, just wanted another thing to go to, which I think more than anything, I don't think there's anybody that is, and I'm sure there's a handful of people that have given up on one site or the other, but the reality is I think most of the people, even though they may publicly say different, are still going to be in tune with both sites if you're that hardcore of a fan. And there was a spot for somebody else to talk about Japanese wrestling. There was a spot for somebody to talk about other independent wrestling and for other voices to get out there and be heard. And that's where I think, too, that VOW did fill and has been filling a big niche.
Now, it's interesting, Joe, that you talk about the reputation you guys have as New Japan cheerleaders, because that's kind of the irony of that is where I want to take this now, because you guys are both big Japanese wrestling fans back in the days when there was nothing happening in Japan. Angry Brian Alvarez voice. You, Joe, were not really a big New Japan guy back then. And Mike, you were. You were sticking through the... In fairness, you have gone through the dark years of New Japan, and you were the person like awaking people like me to the fact that New Japan was doing good things in 2008, 2009, when, or even a little earlier, 2007, because 2007, I remember I was big into Noah like Joe was, which is where I was going to get to next. Joe was a big Noah guy. And I was too. Noah, Dragon Gate were kind of the gateways for a lot of people who were into US independent wrestling. But, and I saw a New Japan card, and I'd see like Orlando Jordan on it in early 2007 and Masahiro Chono, and I just hand waved it. But then it was like the work of you and Adam talking about kind of the things that were good that were happening in New Japan. And then when they really did start to solidify what they were doing, and it got a lot more consistent as the decade came to a close. Joe, you were big into Noah as they went through their big years, big into Dragon Gate. Mike, you were more of a New Japan guy. So I want to kind of talk a little about that mid-2000s scene when you had Noah doing incredible business. New Japan was on the decline. And I kind of want to talk a bit about that scene, memories of it, really what were, I suppose, the PBH years, and maybe even a little before that, so the 2003 to 2007 time. So, Joe, if you want to start maybe telling people about Noah, what it was that got you hooked into Noah, was it All Japan fandom from the 90s carrying over, or was it the rise of guys like Kenta and Marufuji in the tag scene? What was it about pro wrestling Noah that really did it for you?
It's funny, because if I always say this too, if Voices of Wrestling had started in 1990, we'd be the All Japan cheerleader site. And if it was 1995, we'd be the ECW cheerleader site. And if it was 2005, we'd be a Ring of Honor cheerleader site. I have no allegiance to any promotion. It just so happens that New Japan happens to be what I'm super into now, because it's been so good. But it's like you say, in that middle part of the previous decade, I was all about Noah. And you're right, a lot of that came from because I was a big All Japan guy a few years earlier, and then of course the Exodus and all that, but also a lot of it was Kenta and Marufuji. Of course, that great tag team, I guess in the earlier part of the decade, I guess what was that, about 2003, 2004?
Yeah, those are the prime years, I would say.
Right, of that team, and then trying to, you know, watching those guys transition to the top of the card, we all know how it turned out. But you sort of had that mix of the older stalwarts from All Japan. You still had your Misawas and whatnot. Of course, you had the big Kobashi years during that time. And then you had Kenta and Marufuji. And then those mid-cards were just so loaded. Those Budokan Hall shows were just from top to bottom. I mean, they were just incredible. And to me, at that point in time, that was the best wrestling on the planet. And I'll tell you another thing that helped was I would go to these Ring of Honor shows, and they would sell the English language DVDs of the Budokan Hall shows. with Wally Yamaguchi on commentary, you know, who a lot of people know as the Choppy Choppy, your PP guy, and the Val Venus.
Was he doing it solo?
No, I cannot for the life of me remember the play-by-play guy. I cannot remember his name. But
it wasn't Dan the Mount Lavransky, was it?
No, it was another Japanese guy.
Okay.
It was two Japanese. It was Yamaguchi and another Japanese. I can't remember who the other guy was. But that helped too, because I would go to these Ring of Honor shows, man, and I would make a beeline for that merch table. And it wasn't for Ring of Honor DVDs. I was going to all the shows. I didn't need to see the Ring of Honor shows twice. I was looking for those NOAH DVDs, and they were coming out of the old Hawaii U.S. office that they had. And it was all English language, and I remember being all fired up because the Samoa Joe Masawa match, they weren't able to air that one on the DVD because of the TNA deal where, you know, Samoa Joe could not be marketed on DVDs that weren't TNA or whatnot. And I remember everybody being annoyed at that, and I had to track down that match, you know, whether it was, I guess in those days, Mega Upload or whatnot. But yeah, so yeah, I was definitely super into NOAH at that point in time, more than any other promotion, I think.
Mike, would I be right in saying you appreciated NOAH during its big years, but it was never number one in your heart?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, I turned 40 this past February. And, you know, the first time, I mean, you know, New Japan having the association, and I had grown up in the Baltimore, Washington area most of my life. I was born in Chicago, but really when I was five, I moved to Washington. So we were kind of in WWF territory, Mid-Atlantic too, and, you know, we got a lot of different stuff there. It was a ridiculous amount of stuff we ended up getting there. But, you know, you'd always see, what was his name, Sashi Shinma, or I'm trying to think of who, brainlock right now, and who the WWF president was. It was Shinma, I think. And, you know, so there was that on the Coliseum videos when I was a lot younger. They showed Tiger Mask and Cobra, you know. So I, mentally, it was just, it was always New Japan. So I would see him in the magazines, and I would see, you know, Crow Fat and Furnace's name, the Inside Wrestling Roll Call of Champions and stuff like that. But I just had always gravitated towards New Japan. And then as time went on, when WCW and New Japan really started working together, it just made it even easier. And I was a huge, huge fan of the Great Muta, a ridiculously huge fan of the Great Muta. He was like such a revelation the first time I had seen him that I just was in love with him. And I just kind of, again, just another notch on New Japan's side of the belt and everything. And as that kept going on, I didn't have access to All Japan tapes. A lot of people tape traded, and a lot of people had, they were buying All Japan tapes. I realize that, you know, now looking back, but there was a place, a Korean place actually, because there was a high Korean population in the 90s where I was growing up outside of Baltimore. That was growing and growing, and they would get in some Asian stuff, and there wasn't a lot of Japanese stuff, but there would be little things here and there, and there was a guy who had tapes of New Japan. And so when everybody else was watching, you know, all of these matches with Misawa and Kobashi and all that sort of stuff, I was watching Kensuke and Chono and Shinya Hashimoto and couple
Hiro Saito.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well,
Tatsutoshi Goto.
And there was there was another name too, like Mr. Saito. When I was little, I thought he was he was cool. I thought he was awesome. And him and Great Muta are my two favorite Japanese imports of all time in the United States. I thought he is great. I think he is massively underrated as far as what, you know, he was able to do. And I saw him late. As you go back and watch older tape, it's even more amazing in different territories how awesome he was. But I just had always gravitated.
McDonald's wouldn't say so.
Well, yes, I'd always gravitated towards that side. And so it was just, that was mine. And as we rolled into the 2000s, what I really loved became bastardized, and what I really loved got just destroyed. And like Yuji Nagata, who I was a big fan of, liked him WCW, you know, your WCW TV contender, TV title contenders, guys like Yuji Nagata and La Parka and guys like that. I liked him, and Nagata I loved. And then he goes and gets crushed on New Year's Eve. And that's actually how Zach Arnold and I ended up hooking up. Was he was running the Peresu Power site, and it was like, I like this guy. He hasn't wrestled amateur in years. What the hell is going on here? And which was kind of a wake up call on what mixed martial arts was in Japan and what was going on. But I was flabbergasted by it. And as that was going on, you had the NOAH All Japan split, and it was just, I appreciate a lot of those guys. I would watch their stuff, and I really did appreciate it. But to me, the better show, the better excitement. I felt, to me, New Japan was always more alive. The junior heavyweights were important to me, where they weren't important in All Japan for so long. I mean, do you want to see, you know, for me, it's like, you know, you got Fuchi running around there.
They didn't even air a lot of the junior matches in the 90s, like Fuchi and Kikuchi and Crawford and even Rob Van Dam. There's a few matches that aired in full, which are really good between some of those guys, but the majority of it, they didn't even air. And
while that's
really how great was it going to be with just that small pool of guys for a prolonged period?
Yeah, and while that's going on, you got Liger, you got, you know, Kanemoto and Otani. Otani I became a big fan of when I started getting tapes and things like that, but you had all these Wild Pegasus, you had all these cool, flashy guys. And then I did a couple shows for Maryland Championship Wrestling when they had very first began. Axel Rotten led a buddy of mine who was going to Towson. Basically, we were just doing it so we could, you know, have some use of the Comcast cameras that we were able to manipulate and film a bunch of stuff basically for his reel. But since we had the cameras, this guy Craig asked, hey, can we film your shows? And Axel's like, you know, and you can pay us. And Axel's like, nah, I got a guy who's actually paying me to do the shows. But you can hang out and get some experience. It was like, okay, cool. Well, that guy was Feinstein. And I don't want to talk much about him. But at the time, you know, he would have his merch table set up. And the Skydiving Super J was there. Well, let me try that. And let me see this. And let me see that. And I just became even more in the basket of being a New Japan fan where, as much as I appreciate the other stuff, especially after the split happened with Noah and All Japan, it was like I looked at Noah more as a business, and I always had a problem with the way that they did business. For as great as the matches were, for all that sort of stuff, I did not, number one, have an emotional attachment, and two, I hated what they were doing from a business point of view because I thought it would kill them. And ultimately, that ended up happening.
I want to just touch on the two names that Joe mentioned and the would tie into what you're talking about junior heavyweights, that being Kenta and Mara Fuji. Did you find that when those guys kind of rose to prominence, that gave you a bit more of a connection? Was their stuff maybe the stuff on the Noah shows that you were most into?
Oh, yeah. I mean, is that for me or for Joe? I'm sorry.
For you, yeah. I just wanted to kind of touch base on seeing, were you a big Kenta Mara Fuji guy? Because I think I want to talk to both of you guys now about some Kenta Mara Fuji tag memories.
One of my biggest ones, I voted for it for whatever year it was, whether it was 04 or 05, the Dome Show match. And it wasn't like voted it as my third best match, you know, for the Observer end of years. Where it's like that spot is always for the match that personally I liked. It may not have been a 5-star match or anything.
Was this Sugera and Kendo Kashi?
Damn right. I love that match. And that's what killed me. It really killed me on Noah because you have Sugera who had beaten Giant Silva in Pride. And you had Kenta and Mara Fuji who were so great. And I was always a Mara Fuji fan more than a Kenta person. But I mean, all three of those guys should have been pushed and used and treated better, but the mentality was still stuck in the past, and that would kill me. It would drive me nuts. If you go back and listen to those old PPHs, I know we would rant about it at length because it's like, these guys are undeniable, yet you keep denying them. And nothing against Yoshinori Ogawa or anybody else. You know, it's just, they don't deserve the spots that these guys get. And ultimately, by the time they got them, it was too late. And that was just very, very frustrating. And again, because you didn't have that emotional attachment as much as I appreciated them to the Misawas and the Kobashis and the Kawadas, as great as they were, it would really, really bother me more than anything. Because, again, I mean, look at Mara Fuji now, how great he is. You know, look at Sugiura now, how great he is. They should have had those chances then because, damn it, that company needed them.
The Sugera Kashin match from the Tokyo Dome, I think that was the first Kenta Mara Fuji match I ever saw. It might have even been the first Noah match I ever saw. But when I really started just hugely digging those guys was when I saw them in the Differ Cup against Hidaka and Fujita. Joe, do you remember that one? The Differ Cup 2005.
Vaguely, yeah.
That was a crazy tournament where they ran through a very young Kota Ibushi and Kudo, I think, was one of the teams in the early rounds. Spanky and Kaz Hayashi were in there as the Ikemen.
Wow.
The good looking.
God, yeah, this is the Adam Summer special.
Yes, the Ikemen, Leonardo Spanky. But the final was Hidaka and Fujita against Keds and Marufuji. And it was just insane. It was like 30 minutes of nonstop breathtaking action. And that's what Kent and Marufuji were really all about, Joe. It was just that long match that was action from bell to bell, right?
I'll give you a match, and it wasn't even against juniors. What about the match against Morishima and Rikkyo from Budokan? You remember that one?
Oh my God, summer 2006. That was after that match, people were talking about how those four would be the new generation four pillars. That Kenta was the Kawada, Marufuji was the Misawa, Morishima was the Kobashi, and then Rikkyo was the Taue. And that match was so incredible. Just the Kenta and Morishima just stepping up to each other for the first time, and Kenta not backing down from him. That was the match that sold Gabe on Morishima. I remember specifically being at a ROH show in Liverpool in August 2006, and there was a Q&A the afternoon of the show, and I can't remember, was it me that asked the question or not, but Morishima came up, and that match came up specifically, and Gabe talked about how he had just seen him in that match, and it was the only time he'd ever seen him, and he wanted to do big things with him, and he thought he was the future of the business, and God, yeah, that was an incredible match. What was it about that match that really that you loved, Joe?
Well, to me, I mean, that was peak Morishima, I thought, in that match. I mean, he was just a force of nature. When you watch the Morishima matches from that era, and especially that match, you can see why a lot of people thought that he was the future of not only Noah, but of Japan. I mean, the guy was an absolute beast. And then he just, at some point, I don't know if it was injuries or the weight or whatever it was, he just completely fell off the table. But that, you know, that match was a good example. Like, why was that a time limit draw? Like, okay, so you've got these. Now, I don't have the timeline all straightened out. I don't know if that was before or after Marufuji won the title. That was
I think it was a month before.
Why couldn't the juniors just win that match? It's not like, you know, Morishima was still a guy, you know, he wasn't established as a top guy yet. No one really was in that match. Why couldn't the juniors just definitively beat a heavyweight team in that match? Why was that a time limit draw that always bothered me? Maybe it's because I'm a big Kenta and Marufuji fan, and that's why it stings me, but I really felt like, especially if they knew they were going in that direction. I mean, why not just win the match outright? Why the
they main evented? They main evented Budokan. That was July, and they main evented Budokan on Halloween, October 31. They main evented with Kenta versus Marufuji for the title after Marufuji had won it, and they drew, I think, 6,000-7,000. Actually, it might have even been a little more. It might have been 8,000 or 9,000 to Budokan, and they declared the junior experiment a failure, and they took the belt right off Marufuji.
Oh, that was frustrating. And that bothered me so much, because it's like you did the Ogawa thing. It didn't work. You did the Rikkyo thing. It didn't work. You know, it's just you didn't give Aki. And the thing was, you didn't give
Aki. They never did the Akiyama thing.
That's
right.
The thing. And then it's like it's almost like they it's like, well, OK, you guys want a junior. And this is, you know, times they were decent, but they weren't fabulous, where it's just like, okay, we're going to give it to Marufuji, and then 3 months later, it's like Misawa's got it back, and now we're going with Morishima, which would have been fine, but it's like they just never gave him a chance. They looked at him as junior heavyweights, and they were just stuck in a mentality, and I don't know what went on behind the scenes, obviously, or anything like that, but it's like there was it was like one big gigantic mental block where it's like, if we go through this, we can't let any earth gets scorched. We just got to go right back to what we know. And it's like, you're killing it. You got to give it. And crowds kept dwindling and things kept happening and things kept changing until we got to where we got, and it ended up being too late. And that was so damn frustrating.
It was definitely frustrating to follow as a, if you wanted to see progression and people rising. But that said, during those peak years, there are some self-contained things, be it matches or shows, which you can go back and watch now. And oh my God, there are some special moments in Noah. And Joe, I'll throw one at you here. That being the Kobashi Kensuke Sasaki Tokyo Dome match with the famous chop battle, just the incredible atmosphere and spectacle of that match. I think it's one of the all-time great spectacle pro wrestling matches. Just even Noah in general in the Tokyo Dome, I always thought it was a really cool look because they'd have it totally lit up. It was like they were trying to prove a point that they actually fully packed that place to the rafters. They had a legit, I don't know, 50, 55,000 people in there, and they had it fully lit. It was during the day. It just looked really cool. And when I think Noah in the Dome, the Kobashi Kensuke match is the one that comes to mind. But maybe touch on that match, Joe, or any other ones that come to mind when you think Noah at the Tokyo Dome.
Well, I remember that match when it hit YouTube. I mean, because like you said, that was the chop battle itself, you had heard about it, right? But then when you actually watch that chop battle, you can't believe what you're seeing. It feels like it's literally never going to end. It was just, even now, you check it out every couple of years now, maybe once or twice a year, and you watch that match and you just sit there and you shake your head. Like, what the fuck are these guys doing? But they had such presence and so much charisma. And like you said, the atmosphere of the dome as the backdrop as well for those two guys. Yeah, you're right. That was just an amazing spectacle. But when I think of Noah, it's a lot of the smaller moments too. And I want to throw one at you. Because I was talking about this the other day with someone, I can't remember who, and I cannot pinpoint the exact moment either, and I've been looking for this match and I can't find it. But do you happen to remember when Aoki tapped out Kenta for the first time? And it's
yes.
Elevated him up. And I can't remember, I think it was a tag match, but I'm not certain.
I think it was the finals of a junior tag tournament.
Is that what it was?
I think it was 2009.
Because at that point, Aoki still hadn't been established, but that was really his moment that showed, okay, this guy's on the next level now. And that was sort of his big scalp at the time, was tapping out Kenta in this tag match. And I cannot pinpoint the match for the life of me. I looked for it the other day and I couldn't find it.
It was, I'm pretty sure it was a junior tag league 2009, but Aoki was, he was like probably the last, because he came, I think, about a year or 2 years after Go Shiozaki. So Aoki was probably the last great rookie they produced.
Well, Alan, look at that awful class he was in. He came out of the dojo with Genba, who was the next most successful guy. And then you had guys that just did flamed out, like Ippei Ota. Remember that dude?
Ippei Ota, he stayed on the roster. I think it's a few years on from when these things happened, and I was told these in great secrecy, but I'm sure we can talk about it now. Ippei Ota was a guy who was just abused and tormented by people on the roster, Kenta specifically, and he had a couple of years of it, and then I guess he could hack no more. And Akitoshi Ito,
I think was his name.
Ito, a wrestler who was staying in the dojo, told me that he woke up one morning and Ito had, in the middle of the night, literally ran away from the dojo and no one ever heard of him again.
Yeah, it's crazy, you know?
He was like top bunk above Ito. We looked down in the morning, like, Ito was gone. No, where is Ito? No Ito. He's run away, and he was never heard from again because you had certain people who may have been dealt a little bit of karma in the last week or so, just beating the shit out of these guys to such a degree that people from the famed New Japan dojo were like, "Geez, don't want to work with that guy. He's a little rough."
Yeah, and I mean that, and really when you look back, that was a key class. That class basically failing and flaming out. I mean, that contributed a lot to the, look, they were on a downward spiral already, but that was their last chance to come up with somebody. And I mean, Aoki is good. Look, he's he's an excellent wrestler, but you know, we all knew he wasn't going to be a big star. And you can't
have very small as well. Yeah. Nowadays he might not look as small. He still seems pretty small, but I think wrestlers in general got shorter in the last couple of years. But back then he really stood out as particularly short.
Look, I mean, from the jump, you almost knew even that he was just going to be your workhorse type. You know what I mean? Your solid worker on the card. He wasn't going to be a star. And again, you can't have Genba be the second best guy to come out of a class. I mean, that's just it's you know, and they ran two guys off. I don't know what they ever would have became. Probably not much either, to be honest with you. And then right around that time, the two heavyweights were Maybach Taniguchi, which, I mean, geez. And like you said, Go, who I think – Go is a guy I think he – look, I don't know. There's a lot of – he's a victim of circumstance in a lot of ways too, because when they finally put the GHC title on him, it was right around when Misawa died. And it kind of sucked all the he won the title, I think, a week before the Misawa thing.
And no, it was a week after.
It was a week before, a week after.
It was because they vacated, I think, Akiyama's the champion when Misawa died. And Akiyama had to take a leave of absence because he was really upset. And they had Go win the vacant title. I'm pretty sure that's how it went.
And
Go definitely wasn't the champion because Go and Misawa had just won the tag titles, I think, was and they had a big Budokan. The last Budokan before Misawa died, the main event was Go and Misawa against Kensuke and Morishima for the tag titles.
Right. He was Misawa's partner in the match, right?
Yeah, exactly. They just put them together, and he was the thing was he was always kind of Kobashi's guy. But here they are just in that, like, maybe 2 months before they had made him Misawa's. He was Misawa's new partner, and Misawa had taken him under his wing. And that was going to be, I guess, what they used to kind of push him to the top.
Yeah, so he wins the title in the match against Rikkyo. Then he has the one title defense against Saito, which was also weird because these are the two guys that were in the match, you know, when the Misawa thing happened. And then it all the focus was on the tragedy, and then they took it off him and went to Segura, who had, I think that was the long run, right? That was the 2 year run for Segura. And it's just and then when All Japan does their thing with Go, All Japan was in such a dire state that he, you know, that had no chance either. It's just Go is always seems to be a victim, but he really came along at the wrong time. And I think recently seeing him in New Japan and how over he is there, I mean, those fans in Sumo Hall want him dead. I mean, the guy's a heat magnet in New Japan. I mean, it's amazing to see him there in comparison to in modern Noah, where they just don't give a shit about him. Then he goes to New Japan and he looks like the greatest heel on earth. The guy's on fire. You know, all he has to do is little facial expressions, mannerisms, and that place, you know, they want to run him out of the building. So, you know, it's Go came a little too late. Taniguchi was a bust. They ran two of the juniors off in the night, as you've described before. And, it's, you know, we saw what happened from there.
I think I've got your match here, Joe. The Nippon TV Cup Junior Heavyweight Tag League 2009 Block A. I believe this is opening night. Atsushi Aoki and Kota Ibushi defeated Kenta and Taiji Ishimori 21-11.
That's the
Cork
match.
And Hall. Yeah, four good guys in that one.
God, you talk Ishimori. About that lineup, I almost feel better about New Japan. No, I don't, because that's the one thing that helped kill them, too, was guys like Hiroshi Nagao, who ended up having most of his fame as Giant Vabo, the volleyball player in Hustle, and Kenzo Suzuki, and some of those names that New Japan, quote-unquote, developed in the Young Lion system. I tell you, the one guy that does not get anywhere near enough credit for the recovery of New Japan is Choshu. He absolutely doesn't get anywhere near the amount of credit, because when he became foreman of that, and they closed the doors on all the foreigners, and Devitt was the only one basically that was left standing in that dojo.
Devitt and Bernard.
And Giant, and even Bernard, you know, he was in All Japan first. I mean, it's not like, you know, with Rosie and that unit, you know, it was really, you know, Devitt was the only kind of true outside guy. And when they closed ranks and he said, I'm rebuilding this thing back up again, and I'm going to reestablish trust from the fan base, and it's going to be lean, hard times. You know, the move to Jado and Gato was definitely the right thing that happened at the right time. It was a good move to make, obviously, because of how things went. But that man deserves far more credit to get the stench of Enochism off of that product, because, as we all know, I mean, they could not have fallen any lower. And when you look back at even some of the talent that they had on the roster, it's amazing to the depths that they fell under Inoki's reign and under Simon's reign and under Adam's boy, Shibata's buddy, Ueda or whatever, Fumihiko Oai, who started Oai Station.
That's it, was
just they did such damage to that thing. And the fact that the dojo, and granted, I could bitch about it now and talk at length about how DDT and Big Japan and Dragon Gate have blown them away as far as developing talent, and they haven't been able to get some of these young people who are now cutting their teeth on those products and not just theirs in all Japan like it used to be back in the day. They did a horrible job with themselves, and they did a horrible job developing.
I think to bring it to New Japan and what I think, or I think they were really steadying the ship, and I think the big run for me that I think showed me, okay, this is a promotion that's getting its legs under it here now that I should be paying attention to, was in 2007 when Nagata and Tanahashi exchanged belts, and they had three matches for the title, which I'd like to point out at this moment, I discussed these three matches with Yuji Nagata himself in the corridor of Korakuen Hall this year.
You're such a name dropper, Alan. You really
The best was that. So, okay, one of the matches I was going to mention during this feud was when Nagata had the belt and he had a title defense against Makabe. And Mike, I'm sure you remember the match they basically bludgeoned each other. It was so bloody. Nagata busted Makabe and his cronies busted Nagata up with a scissors on the outside, and then Nagata got him back in the ring and busted him up with. People think the Brock Lesnar, Randy Orton shoot elbows were bad, and they were. This Yuji Nagata series of elbows onto Togi Makabe's hardest fuck head in the corner, which was used to split him open. This is like probably the last. Insane bloody match in New Japan, because they don't really do the blood anymore, and this match will be special for me because the first time I ever talked to Dave Meltzer was when I called into Wrestling Observer Live and I put this match over to him. I was like, Dave, you gotta watch this match, and he got all excited because he was being allowed to talk about Japan. And when I was briefly talking to Nagata at his merch table this year, and we were talking about the Tanahashi matches, and then I was like, and during the feud, you wrestled Makabe, and he starts shaking his head, and he goes, oh, very bloody, very bloody. Just like I had awoke a horror memory in his head.
That is so awesome. A great bash heel. I tell you, and there was a great gimmick change. Nobody gave a shit about Shinya Makabe. Nobody could believe that they actually had him, like, they thought he was going to be a junior heavyweight. You look at him now, it's like, Jesus Christmas.
Even when you go back and watch, like, those junior tags that he was a part of, like, he wasn't that much smaller. Like, he bulked up somewhat, but he was still a big dude. Like, that guy then would never be a junior heavyweight in any. He was not making the Cruiserweight Classic 205 pound limit. No way.
No, and it's like, you know, you think about, like, they he was going to be a junior. Taguchi was going to be a heavyweight at some point. It's just like, how are these body? I don't know what body shapes are like, but you know, the science behind them. But I don't think this is going to work out in that way, and it didn't. But God, Nagata is so unbelievably underrated. He always will be to me. You know, talk about the glue that kept that thing together. And again, I was devastated. And Alan, you know the deal with Nakamura, because I had always, from the first time I had seen him, said there's money in this guy. I believe in this guy. He's got a charisma about him. And when everybody, I don't understand. I can't believe I was the only one. And I understand if you, out of the new three musketeers, you know, the new Chono, Hashimoto, and Muda, when it came to Tanahashi, Shibata, and Nakamura, I can see liking the other two for whatever reasons more than Nakamura. But he was so put down upon. And I think in a way that there are great parallels between the two guys in that, you know, Nagata, they stuck him out there for that shoot fight with Krokop. He gets laid out. All of a sudden, he's Mr. Deadstock. All of a sudden, because he lost a shoot fight to a kickboxer. And you know, because it's like, it's not his fault. You know, he did what he was supposed to do as a company man. Just because you thought he'd be able to take down Krokop because you didn't really know what Krokop was about then, you know, that's his fault. And they tried to rebuild him. They gave him wins over a bunch of shooters that, you know, you watch those matches in hindsight, I think they're damn good. You know, the ones with Boss Rutan, and some of them are bad, but it's like, you know, they did what they could to try to get him over. That Tokyo Dome show on the 4th, he goes and he, you know, beats the shit out of Takayama. Then you have Nakamura. You have what happened to him with Alexei Ignashov in K1 on the Inoki Bombay show, I believe it was. That piece of garbage. And, you know, what do you do on 1-4 when the kid's got a broken eye socket? You have Takayama just beat the shit out of him. And yes, Nakamura ultimately got the win, but he didn't get it in a way that really got him over. And then he's got this, now he's Mr. Deadstock run, and it's like, I never thought he'd recover from that. And I always thought that was a gigantic sin. And thank God he went to Mexico and was able to do what he was able to do there and turn himself around and discover, really, you know, get comfortable with who he wanted to be. And I was very hesitant when he came back doing the Michael Jackson thing and everything, because he went from, you know, pure sports, you know, black longer pants and, you know, team leader of sports groups, you know, sort of deal, you know, offshoots of Nagata, you know, that Nagata had what, Gags or whatever it was that was short last, and Nakamura was leading New Japan Black, and it was sort of kind of the same
Rise quality. The real international super elite, yeah. What a faction that was. You had get this for a faction, everyone: Nakamura, Milano Collection AT, yes. young boy Finn Balor, Minoru Tanaka, Tyson Tomko, Giant Bernard, Hiroki Goto, and then the kicker, the best one in the bunch, former WCW Nitro standout Ric Fuller.
That's right, Ric Fuller.
But because I think Tomko left and they like needed a replacement partner for Bernard, so they're like, who's a big American guy that we can get on the cheap? Because there wasn't much money in the New Japan coffers at this point when they're rebuilding. This guy, Ric Fuller, will do. And you know what? In fairness, he was serviceable in New Japan. Ric Fuller was serviceable.
Yeah, I mean, for again, you didn't have to look. He was more serviceable than, like, you know, Rosie or R-O-N-Z, whatever the hell his name was. Like, you know, the flip side was in All Japan. So if you looked at it that way, it was a win. But, you know,
they were able to ditch Ric Fuller because they got someone on the cheap, even more so. Someone was willing to come in for even less. That being one, Carl the Machine Gun Anderson.
Yeah, but it's like, I remember thinking at the time of that one, and God bless you, good brother Carl. You know, I don't mean anything by this, but it was like, so let me get this straight. You know, I can't remember if it was, he was teaming with Adam Pearce or wherever it was, where they were NWA champions or whatever, but it was like, huh, you know, all right, New Japan Dojo guy. It just, it wasn't, I'm thinking, nah, you know, and Adam's thinking, nah.
See, I had seen it. I remember you guys not being into that, but because you see him on the surface and he's not the most spectacular looking individual. And you kind of see like a lot of, okay, he's doing, as you said, like NWA stuff. Yeah, I think he was a tag team with Joey Ryan. They were doing a thing.
That may have been the team,
Where I had seen him was on PWG shows, where he was just doing kind of goofy shtick on the undercard, and you were seeing his personality. His gimmick was based around the fact that he had a really sweet hat. Like, he was just, it was like this baseball cap that he was just like, I got a sweet hat, man. Don't touch my hat. And I was like, this guy's hilarious. So I had a soft spot for him when he came in. So I was kind of, I was like the one person who I think was watching New Japan that knew of him from that. So I was kind of like, no, give this guy a chance. He could be all right.
Well, the machine gun gimmick like a derivative of like a Chicago gangster kind of deal? And that was the whole thing behind that back when he was a California guy?
But yeah, they didn't have the sound effects, but he'd do the thing himself that he would always do during his intro in New Japan, where they'd actually play the sound effect. But yeah, he'd just always get the ring announcer to stop, and he'd be like, on the machine gun, and he'd do the pose, and
It wasn't Rise around the same time as the CTU like junior deal with Liger
CTU spanned a few years before Rise came along,
because Goto was, and Devitt were in that too, right? So
yeah, that was when Devitt just started. They put him in as the basically the he was put in as the young boy of that group. But then once he was like in the role that Cody Hall was in the Bullet Club, was the Bullet Club young boy. He was the CTU young boy. But then they had when CTU split up, he needed a home, so he ended up landed in Rise. But Joe, what did you, just to bring him back to Nakamura, I'm curious because I don't think I really know, what did you think of Nakamura before current incarnation Nakamura? Did you see much in him? Were there any particular highlights that stood out to you, or what were your thoughts on him in general?
I thought he was boring. I'll be honest about it. I thought he was pretty boring, and I thought that first series of matches against Tanahashi during that period, I guess 2008, 2009, they were always good matches, but there was always something about them preventing those matches from being great.
Yeah, I think I'd feel the same. I know their first Tokyo Dome title match where they were in the main event, they had a U30 Tokyo Dome match, which I think might have been in the main event as well a year or two before. But their first IWGP heavyweight title main event was the 2008 Dome.
That would be right, because I think the U30 one was like 07 or something. One is so, yeah, that's right.
No, I think U30 was 05 or 06 even. But the 08 match, It was built up real well. I was like, okay, they're building up the two future guys that are just at top of this company now for the next few years. Tanahashi's had the title, but they're going to move it on to Nakamura now and give him his run. This is going to be his big crowning match. And I'm with you. It was good, but it wasn't great. It was not a patch on what we've got recent years as far as Tokyo Dome main events.
They never took any of those matches, in my opinion, to the next level. You know, they would always go out there and give you a well-worked, solid 3.25 star match. But there was something about those matches that just they couldn't cross the goal line into making them great matches. And to circle back to what you asked me about Nakamura, I mean, think about where I'm coming from. I'm a big Noah guy at the time, right? And I'm a big All Japan guy before that. Man, I like my bombs. I like my head drops. I like guys throwing each other. I like my huge closing stretches. And that is not what New Japan was at that time. And that definitely is not what Nakamura was during that point in time.
Let me just interject real quick. And there was one of the reasons another reason is talked about some of the ones at the beginning that I always gravitated towards New Japan more than All Japan. I had done a little boxing. I've done a little wrestling. I played football. And there was always a mentality to me when it came to some of that stuff where it's like, it's a work. And I know that's why people loved it, but and I can't say, you know, it's not like there wasn't Kensuke Sasaki and other people on the New Japan side doing it, but it was like there just seemed to be more pizzazz and more charisma and charm and entertainment to it, where it was like when it came sometimes to All Japan and with Noah, it's just like, Jesus, you know, come on. You know, it's you're not getting benefits forever from this.
Nakamura around that 2008 time, he was kind of, in some ways, I know you saw the potential in him, Mike, and it turns out you were right, but at that point he was really the worst of both worlds, because he wasn't giving Joe the bombs, yeah, and the big crazy closing stretches, but he also really wasn't showing a lot of personality or pizzazz, as you said. So he was in a rough spot.
And
but
the worst part
he managed to get through it.
The other guys lapped him so fast, and I want to say they lapped him in different ways. Tanahashi just lapped him, period. You know, Tanahashi, and a lot of people don't remember this, and you guys will, but it was like, do you remember when he was stabbed by the girlfriend and he took himself to the hospital on the scooter? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I remember you guys talking about it, but it was before I got into
it. And it was like, this guy, there was a mentality still then that it's like, because he was stabbed by the woman, that showed weakness. And it was like, what? I mean, I'd make something out of this. And it was like, but he just far lapped everybody. Shibata left and in a different way established himself for those people that like an Adam who are footin', you know, they like that sort of, they loved that. And a lot of the, you know, the hard kicky style and things like that, they appreciated that. And for
he had more fire than Nakamura, yes, when they were younger.
Yes, Shibata. He did. And for the older New Japan fan too, he he felt a little bit more throwback like, and even though he wasn't a junior heavyweight, he felt like an Otani. He felt like a Kanemoto. Plus just the fact that he was a heavyweight. So there was that. Yoshi, you know, was, you know, Big Pink. You know, it's like the guys that were in that class that were kind of coming out and kind of his people, whereas he was the one that was pushed highest. It's like there's these other guys who are more comfortable with who they were, and he had no fucking idea who he was, you know, which was obvious in hindsight when you look at 2004 Supernova winning the belt over Tenzan compared to dude coming out dancing on the stage, you know, on his last Wrestle Kingdom show.
Last thing on the New Japan side before we move on to something different is I just want to talk about the junior heavyweight scene, which in the early 2000s and the 90s was obviously praised a huge amount. Guys like you just mentioned, Otani, Kanemoto, Minoru Tanaka, one of my favorite wrestlers ever, Liger, of course.
Heat. I love that too. Talk about CTU before. Well, I loved Heat.
I was going to say in the mid-2000s, Mike, you like Heat, but Heat didn't really get over.
He didn't.
To be fair,
no, sir.
Heat didn't get over, and there was also Tiger Mask. They were positioning as the top guy in the junior division.
Ugh.
And that New Japan junior division in the mid-2000s took quite the nosedive, but it came to life again in the sort of later part of the decade. My boy Fergal Devitt, they put that thing on his back. The tag team with Ryusuke Taguchi, where Taguchi really sort of refound himself, and Apollo 55 was born, and they did such really great things. They brought in the Motor City Machine Guns. There was a match that I know you love, Mike, Devitt versus Milano Collection AT in the Best of the Super Juniors 2009. And that Super Juniors 2009 was the one where they really filled that up with a lot of crazy guys from outside the company. They had Ibushi in there. I think Fujita Junior Hayato was
Yamato.
In there that year. Yamato was in there, beating Jushin Liger in 2 minutes.
Yes.
They really
put an end to Dino was in it.
Dino was Super J Cup.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yamato was in both, so they can kind of blur into one. But Devitt doing the double stomp onto Dino's balls will never. That is one of the greatest finishes I've ever seen. So like, Devitt's answer to Dino gimmick was, all right, I know how to beat this guy. I'm doing a fierce double stomp. And he laid that double stomp in. He laid it in. He landed that thing and he stuck it right in the man's groin. He held it in there. And they put an emphasis on trying to rebuild that junior division as the decade came to a close. And it was so perfect for Devitt, and he overcame his early injuries. And I really thought that New Japan Junior Heavyweight Division at the end of that last decade historically deserves more praise than I think it's going to get. Joe, what are some of your memories of kind of great moments and matches from around that time?
I think you stole my thunder, the one I was going to bring up, the Apollo 55 Motor City Machine Gun matches. Now, they might have been a little later. They might have been into the next decade. Was that 09?
It was 09, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, I think those are underappreciated. You know, and I think that probably, despite the fact that they have all these great junior teams now and we all bang our head against the wall because they're in four-way matches on every show, that was probably the last great tag team in-ring rivalry that they've had on the junior side. And I always point to those matches when people ask me, yo, Joe, give me something before 2012. I'm an Okada era fan. Give me, you know, some stuff to watch. I always point them to that series of tag matches. I thought they were excellent.
They hold up really well. It was really cool seeing Devitt gradually get more over in Corrigan Hall, where it was one of those machine gun matches where at the end of the match, he got to cut this promo for the crowd, and they responded to him so well. I was like, oh my God, he is hitting superstar level here in this company. It might take another couple of years for it to come to full form, but he is well on his way. This crowd absolutely adore this guy because he was just so likable. You could see how hard he was working and how much he gave his all in those matches. And it was cool to see.
And that J-Cup, that J-Cup at the end of the year where you brought up the double stomp to Dino's nuts. Remember, Devitt beat a guy we talked about earlier in the first round, I believe. Didn't he beat Atsushi Aoki in the first round of that tournament, Super J Cup?
I think he did, yeah. I think Devitt beat Aoki, Dino, and Yamato, and then he lost to Marufuji in the final.
Yeah.
But the big match that came from that tournament was Koji Kanemoto versus Fujita Jr. Hayato, which I will say that is one of the greatest pro wrestling matches I've ever seen.
And that put Hayato on the map. I mean, people who were hardcore, super hardcore Puro fans knew about him already, but that was sort of his big time moment where everybody opened their eyes to that guy.
13 minutes of absolute magic. That match was incredible.
Yeah, and it's like a lot of people, it's not the same, but it's like a lot of people talk about what Kota Ibushi will or won't do now, and the fact that he's such a free spirit, he does what he wants to do. You know, still, it's just like, if can you imagine if Hayato Jr. Fujita would have been full-time in New Japan after that? But
well, those are the two guys. It was that point where they were opening up those junior tournaments to all these outside guys. The two guys they wanted were Hayato and Ibushi. They wanted those guys to be full-time New Japan. They eventually, after years of trying to convince and coerce and giving him the title, they eventually got Ibushi as a part-time guy, but they were never even able to get that from Fujita. And that's the crazy loyalty that you see in Japan with these guys to their home promotions. He's going to be loyal to this northern region tiny promotion that tours and runs like weird holiday camp shows essentially in front of like 30 or 40 people at times, and because he's loyal to Jinsei Shinzaki. He's loyal to Sasuke or however it might be, that he would turn down that career opportunity of going to New Japan. It's amazing.
I'll give you guys another one from a couple years later. It's not really the same era, but how do you think things are different? I'd like both of your takes on this. If Daishi Hashimoto doesn't break his arm before that Tokyo Dome show and he actually works that show.
I forgot about that. Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a chance that he sticks around and they hold on to him? Because they never re-explored that. He broke his arm, they pulled him off the show, and that was that.
No, and that's why I don't know what exactly would have happened, but I think what happened would have happened. And he probably would have been still closer to Fujinabe and closer to other people, where I don't know who he's ever had in his ear, but it just... Again, he doesn't have any loyalty to New Japan, and for whatever reason that is, I don't know what it is, but I frankly, how everything has turned out, the fact that he hasn't really been back or anything like that, and there's never, you know, it'll pop up every once in a while, but then, you know, there's always a hand wave either way on it. I just can't believe he would have stayed, especially with as tumultuous as it was at the time in New Japan.
I don't think he was. I don't think he was ready then. I think he's only beginning to be ready now. And I think, strangely enough, with all these, this is how I view it as a non-Japanese speaker who's not able to read any articles or anything like that. But from very much the outside, this is the vibe I've gotten. He's had all these guys: Chono, Inoki, Muto, at 01. All these people. Otani always seemed to really look out for him. He always seemed to stand by him, in fairness to Otani. But all these different guys, legends, different companies that all wanted to do this, that, or the other with him, ends up in IGF. So you can clearly see, like, he's having a lot of mixed thoughts. If that's where you end up, is the craziness of IGF. But the one time he would always seem like he was comfortable and like he was happy and that he was enjoying being a pro wrestler was when he was sleazing it up with all Kazuki Hashimoto on Big Japan shows, and they were doing the double Hashimoto's tag team. It was like the least prestigious thing he'd do, but it was always where he looked most comfortable. And
because you don't have the pressure of all those old guys or the pressure of being little Hashimoto or being, you know, and that playing pop psychologist, that's what I would assume, at least.
Yeah, and now, as it's turned out, this year, after the IGF thing was essentially him hitting rock bottom, and where else was there to turn, January comes around this year, Big Japan say, hey, come full-time with us. You get to learn under Daisuke Sekimoto. you're basically entering pro wrestling rehab when you go to Big Japan now, because look at all the guys. Kohei Sato, Ryota Hama, Hideki Suzuki.
Kohei Sato, boy.
Seiya Sanada. That guy is 6 months this year in Big Japan. Hey, January 2016, Seiya Sanada was not ready for this run that he is on in New Japan. April, May, when he joined aboard New Japan after having done the Big Japan Strong Climb and working with all those guys all year, that guy was, he was able to come on board and hang in New Japan. Big Japan, I don't know what it is about there, but just being around Sekimoto and being around Okabayashi, people just find their feet as wrestlers. It's happened so often in the last 2 years with different guys. And I think Hashimoto might become the biggest example of that when it's all said and done.
In the New Japan, I'm not saying they need to rate it, but I want to circle back to the juniors real quick. You know, Tiger Mask, who I've never liked. You know, I referred to him as Four for years because I just couldn't even stand to bring, you know, call him Tiger Mask. When they signed him from Mikanoshu, it was like, it was a great move. And it was like, okay, that was a time where they would poach and they would negotiate and they would be able to bring guys in. And the reason it fell off for so long was they just didn't do that. And they de-emphasized everything, and they really de-emphasized the division to the point where it was like, you know, yes, there was some great stuff going on in Milano, and there were guys that would come in. You know, they tried with Heat. You had Devitt, but it was a different, you know, it was a different time then. It just, they couldn't just not get out of their own way. And the focus was not there. And they would fall back on guys like El Samurai too much. And they would fall back on Tiger Mask. And they fall back Wataru Inoue, who I never liked. And there was another example of a guy. It's like you knew, you could see it coming from a million miles away. And it's not like he was an awful junior heavyweight, but comparatively speaking, he was a very flat and boring one. And you knew the path he was going to take, and they were teaming him with Nagata. And it's like, okay, he's going to end up dropping the junior title. He's going to move on, become a heavyweight. And it's like, really? And that's exactly what happened.
For modern fans, Wataru Inoue is Yoshihashi before he found himself this year.
Was there a less apropos nickname than Mr. High Tension? I mean, there was tension with this guy. You know?
Yeah, he gave me high tension to watch the son of a bitch beat guys like Taguchi and Milano and all those guys. But it drove me nuts, and it was like, oh, God. And here's the funny part to me with Devitt. Is like with WrestleLand and with Lockup, and they did that little deal and everything. And Taguchi was really focused. I mean, people will remember Nakanishi more than any, and they should for that puffy white pirate shirt that he wore. But you know, Taguchi was a big part of that. And it's always funny. I don't know what the intention ever was going to be, but I'm not saying that Devitt killed Taguchi, but inadvertently, Devitt killed him, because you couldn't not go against Devitt. There were times where it's like he should probably drop the belt because it would help Taguchi, but you didn't want him to drop the belt because, you know, why would you, don't screw up with what you got going on. And I think inadvertently it really did kill Taguchi, because by the time it happened, it was already over. The gig was up. There were other guys on the rise. Things had changed too much where, now he just, it's like he flipped that, lost his mind, and became comedy guy. And you know what? That's okay, because he's got a job for the rest of his life. But it's kind of funny with what they really had behind Taguchi at one time, what it could have been. It just, unfortunately for him, Devitt just could not let that happen.
Taguchi never seemed like he was motivated enough that he wanted to be the guy. He was happy to give you that one or two epic matches a year. Like I also always say that 2011 Best Super Juniors final with Ibushi is one of the best New Japan matches, one of the best Ibushi matches ever. And Taguchi was incredible. He gave a performance in that very much like the performance he gave with Ospreay this year. And he's good for that one match. He seems like he'll step it up one match a year and just give you his everything. But he's good. He kind of feels like, hey, I've done my one match now. I'm just going to chill and like hit people in my ass.
That's exactly it. He's like RVD got smoked up or something. And remember, he even had that little smoking gimmick for a while. He would do the blow of the, you know, do the circle spin around and everything. And it's, I think, Adam, I don't know if we talked about it on air. We probably didn't, but it was like, you know, we wondered about that because you're right.
What the fuck was that stable? That was him, Yujiro, and El Samurai, right?
Oh, God.
They had some
Samurai
wacky name.
For sure was in one, yeah.
Yeah, they had some wacky name, and their gimmick was that, yeah, they like smoked cigarettes and drank and stuff.
See, and it just, it just didn't come to pass. But we would talk about it. It was like, yeah, there would be something missing. And again, then really Devitt was on the rise and he was getting passed by. And it was like, well, but there you go.
Wasn't Yujiro part of that? Wasn't it the three of them?
Yeah. Baby Yujiro. I can't think of the name. They were like a. It was, I remember it was around the same time, and this will be a nice transition from my next one. It was around the same time as Tozawa Juku in Dragon Gate.
You know, it was just Samurai Jim. It was the Samurai Jim.
Samurai Jim. That was it, because Tozawa was like a boarding school, and then Samurai's was like his gym for his pupils, but it was more teaching them how to smoke and drink rather than like become good wrestlers. Maybe that's why Yujiro never amounted to anything.
And I thought, now there was one of my big fails, Yujiro. And I, you know, those two, I'm like, I'm putting my cart behind Yujiro. And, you know, I guess there's something fitting it. About that.
the story I always heard about Taguchi is that he would constantly tell them no when they wanted to move him up to heavyweight. I don't know if there's any truth to that or if you guys heard different, but that speaks to Alan's point of him not being motivated.
Well, that was true, because I think the deal was, though, and again, I don't know if these were on old Adam and shows with Adam, and I'd probably have to pick his brain about it too, but I think one of the things was he was supposed to, I think it was with the belt and everything else of like, there was things that he wanted to do and get over or whatever it was in the junior heavyweight division and that he thought he was going to and then just didn't. And he, again, I don't know what the mentality would have been, but I think looking at Inoue and that sort of thing, well, like, you're going to move me up and you're going to kill me. You know, when we have guys like Tanahashi and Nakamura and other guys that they were focusing on, I don't know if that could have been it. I'd have to actually ask Adam and try to go back and listen, but that sounds very, very familiar. I think you're absolutely right.
I remember you guys talking about that on the show back all those years ago. I definitely remember that as a discussion point from the time. But
Alan, let me derail your show here.
Go for it.
Because I know you want to jump into Dragon Gate. But before we do that, I got something I want to throw at you guys since we were talking about Noah versus New Japan here for the last hour or so. Do you guys see in modern New Japan, my argument has always been that the modern New Japan style is more of a King's Road style than a Strong style. I mean, it seems like these guys grew up watching Misawa and Kobashi toss each other on their heads and have these great closing stretches. And to me, the New Japan main event style is more akin to that, to the old King's Road style than it is the Strong. Because when I think Strong style, I think of like flash knockouts and guys tagging each other and finishes coming out of nowhere. Hashimoto kicking your head off.
Well,
I don't
even
like that out of New Japan.
Yeah, people don't know what the term strong style means and what it represents. It's been so it's so out there now, and
it's a bastardized term. People think it means
people don't realize like, go back and watch, like, a Choshu Masa Saito match from, like, 1987, where they're just, like, busting each other really hard with lariats, and then it's, like, hard kicks, and then it just ends really out of nowhere with, like, a realistic-looking hold. That's what shoot style is. Whereas strong style, I should say, people, like, see a crazy a match of like loads of crazy German suplexes and big near falls, and they think, oh, that's strong style. No, that's more King's Road. And I think, Joe, what I would say about the New Japan main event style, I think it's a combination of King's Road and the best things about classic main event WWE style.
Exactly.
Your Shawn Michaels style epic. Because who does Hiroshi Tanahashi say his favorite wrestler of all time is? Shawn Michaels. It's clear he's been massively influenced by him. And who has influenced and molded the current New Japan main event style more than Hiroshi Tanahashi? Because he's been the linchpin from 2007 to today. He's the guy who it's he was the guy on the rise. He was the guy that was at his peak, and then he's been the guy on the slide down, putting over the next crop of guys. And Okada has his own. He has his own spin on things, and the more he has his own spin on things, the better, because it's good for guys to have their own vibe and their own feel, because that's what makes wrestling cool, is where you get guys with different vibes and different feels crossing paths and going against each other. That's why this Kenny Omega Okada match is so interesting as a first time matchup at the Tokyo Dome, because they're two guys with slightly different kind of ways they go about big main event matches. So it'll be interesting to see how it gets crossed up. But
The influences with Okada too is, again, it's these guys, you know, did he come out of the dojo system? Yes, he did. Did he already have several years of cutting his teeth being a large man? And this is kind of the Luke Harper the karate. It took me years to not call him, you know, to actually start calling him Luke Harper, almost, or Brody Lee in Chikara, where it's like, okay, slightly bigger man. You got all these other little small guys flying around here. And as wrestling has changed, as the business has changed, as different guys have gotten into it, and as the mentality of fans have changed, Okada, starting with Ultimo Dragon, you know, put a new spin on everything. And also the influence of obviously, you know, Shawn Michaels as well too. But it's like, here's a 6'4" guy who can work with everybody. And again, different than Luke Harper, but the same sort of thing, where it's like, I can picture Luke Harper punching Brock Lesnar in the face, but I can also picture Luke Harper, you know, taking a Hurricanrana from, you know, Kalisto or whoever, you know, would it be too. And that's where, again, as time moves on a little bit, there's where guys like Okada, that's where it's really going to make him stand out and shine and really be the torchbearer. Obviously he is already, but really be the standard bearer for the new millennium is, or for the next couple of years, is because of that base that he has, that he got early on before he ever entered New Japan.
Well, you know what's actually interesting? He definitely did get a different base from training under Ultimo, and that, but that's very specific, and he's been able to take specific things about that and work them into a style with a lot of his submissions that you see him do during his matches. When he's like kind of working a guy over, he'll hit a lot of Toriumon style submissions, and it's when you see him in these six-man tags at Fantastica Mania, and he's able to work really well with the luchadors. But the thing about Okada, which I don't know how much this is a known thing that's out there, but people talk about his US excursion as a waste of time and how he got nothing from it, but there was something he really did get from it, and this is the ultimate making the best of a bad situation, because Okada was not a big, huge wrestling fan. He was not hugely into it. He didn't know a lot about wrestling. He didn't know a lot about the different wrestling from around the world, the different guys. He wasn't a student of the game like some people are when they come up. Daisuke Sekimoto was watching the first Ring of Honor shows in 2002 when he was like a young boy in Big Japan. So you have some guys that are students of the game, Chris Hero, but Okada wasn't. And Okada was over in the US, and TNA was doing nothing with him. And you know who was doing something with him? It was Alex Shelley. Alex Shelley was letting Okada live with him and force-feeding him pro wrestling tapes around the clock. And Okada was into it, and he got into it, and he watched all that stuff, and he learned. And Shelley would be showing him shit from everywhere. And that is where Okada learned different wrestling.
And I heard Okada, I actually heard Okada say, speak to this. He said that while he was here, he didn't get to wrestle much, and he wasn't happy about that, but he did say he watched a ton of tape. And the guy he said he took a huge liking to and tried to pattern himself after was Sting.
Yeah, he'd see Sting at the TNA shows during like entrances and stuff, and he said he'd take a lot of he'd take note of just the way he carried himself.
The aura,
and,
yeah.
And stuff. Yeah, so Okada learned a lot from being over in America in not the traditional way. He could have come over, and if he had no one looking out for him, or if he had like a maybe like, I don't know, because no one else comes to mind, but just Brian Christopher looking out for him. And Brian Christopher, he was staying in Brian Christopher's apartment. Brian Christopher, because he's the guy, the infamous story that sticks in my head of when Eddie was on the Indies after getting fired from WF, and he was doing Ring of Honor and all that, and he was straightening IWA himself out. South, before. Yeah, he was straightening himself out before he went back to WF because they wanted him clean before they'd ever take him back. And I remember this story of him being on a UK tour and Brian Christopher just begging him to go drinking and doing drugs with him. And he just had him all night to do it. Just, come on, man. Come on. Don't be such a stuck in the mud, man. Come on. Do this coke with me, man. Come on. And Eddie just having, like, every corner Eddie went around, he was just trying to get away from this guy. And Brian Christopher would just pop up in front of him with a bag of coke and just, come on. Oh,
can you
man.
See him bright red, too, like a Muppet? Just that bright red face that he
Hey, dude. I fucking backstage at WXW last year found myself babysitting this dude. Then I just washed my hands of him when he chopped me fucking hard as shit. And I was like, someone else can look after this fucking nut job, because him and Scotty Too Hottie arrived and Scotty Too Hottie wanted absolutely nothing to do with him. I guess he had been traveling with him for the whole day and he did not want to be. He immediately, they arrived at the venue, he beelined away from Brian Christopher, and all of a sudden everyone else was gone and I was stuck with Brian Christopher. I was like, how the fuck did this happen? And
now I just have this I just have this mental image in my head now of an alternate universe Okada living with Brian Christopher doing blow, watching Bill Dundee and Moondog tapes while Wolfie D's banging a hooker in the corner, and how things would have turned out from there. You know, you paint a very interesting picture. Instead, we had, you know, he's hanging out with Alex Shelley, a mild-mannered video game player, new age wrestler, you know, watching the proper tapes and getting proper nutrition and living the straight lifestyle. So, you really got me painting that picture in my head now of how that would have turned out. You know what? He'd probably be slumming it up with Fujita Hayata up in northern Japan, you know, working Dove Pro shows. That's how Okada would have turned out. He would be working sleazy indies right now, doing
Nosawa Tokyo Dream Show or that.
He'd be the third member of who are my boys? The Brahmin brothers.
Well, that's interesting because the Brahmin brothers were Pretty Boy Toriumon graduates too.
Oh, the Sailor Boys. Yes.
They were the Sailor Boys. It was Brahmin Chu, Brahmin K, and the front of their group, because they were a singing trio called the Sailor Boys. The front was Taiji Ishimori. So you're Taiji Ishimori and the future Brahmins is these. They basically look like two BB Hulks because they're kind of tall and they're similar looked up to Hulk. And then Toriumon kind of that class kind of fell apart and scattered in different directions. And they got skullets and became what they have become.
Now that would probably be a great transition to Shima. But let me just put an exclamation point and a very controversial statement. I will say this. I did not like Vince Russo. I've never liked Vince Russo. I don't like anything Vince Russo did. But when it came to Okada, like, I don't know, because I'm old, and even this show is so old that I had to see it in reruns, and they only made like 10 of them, and that was it. The Green Hornet, that I know everybody hated the Okado thing, but if you actually treated that seriously and you had ever seen the show and you actually made Okado like the Bruce Lee ass-kicking character that was the assistant in that show, it actually probably would have worked. But because it's Vince Russo and because they're idiots, instead you had the Pope, like, what did they strung him up and whipped him or something like that, whatever it was like, man, you could take even the, because it was like, well, this is kind of a cool idea. You could even take that and ruin anything. So fuck you, Vince Russo.
Plus, Okada wasn't really a karate man. And the only reason he was a karate man in Vince's eyes is because, you know, he was Asian.
He was Japanese, yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, he has to be a karate man. So we'll give him a karate man gimmick. You know, so that was the whole extent of it. So it probably wouldn't have worked anyway, because he's definitely not a karate man.
I just really liked that show. That was a cool show. that was like a Batman for older people. It's like, wow, so it's not all comedy. You can actually have some cool shit here. Plus, it was Bruce Lee. And again, if you come from my generation, it was like, man, that's all you ever knew of, like, kind of martial arts was, I want to be Bruce Lee.
All right, now, guys, I got a question for both of you to answer. Just straight up, single answer is all I need for this. Mike, first. When did you first see Toriumon / Dragon Gate? What year? And what year did you first hear of it? And what year did you start watching it, if you can remember?
God, I don't remember. And I know it was still Toriumon. It was before Dragon Gate.
Pre-split.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely pre-split, because I'm one of those psychopaths that's always been a huge Ultimo Dragon mark. And I didn't have a vote for the Hall of Fame then, but I can say this. It didn't hurt my feelings when he was voted in. It didn't hurt my feelings when John Molinario had him as one of the top 100. And I think it was writing for The Torch at the time, where I actually asked some people, including Todd Martin, who I think was doing and contributing for The Observer. He was one of them. I think I asked Dave. I asked a handful of people for their opinions on an article I wrote for The Torch about Ultimo way back then, as far as being on that list. But it was then, because, again, my brother, being a little bit younger too, was really, he got really into the, I guess I think we called it the Northeast style at the time, of, you know, Kai and Tai and these other guys who were in like the WCW versus the World game and stuff like that. And he would go actively seek out that stuff. Like, he was an even bigger junior heavyweight fan than I was. So, like, he loved Jado and Ghetto and all, you know, all of that stuff. As the 90s rolled into the 2000s, I was a big Ultimo Dragon fan. So it was still the Toriumon gym. I couldn't tell you when, but I remember, you know, Shima Nobunaga and, oh God, was it Doi second? I forget. I can't even remember. It was Doi.
Second Doi.
Yeah, second Doi, and like that sort of stuff. So it was then. I can't tell you what it was, but I know when I was sold for good, and that was like a lot of people, it was the ROH shows with Dragon Gate, because obviously we had talked about it, we had seen it, we talked about it, but it was always very secondary on the PPH. But it kind of was like, you know, we had seen these matches and it's like they're amazing. But like when they got over, when they came over for WrestleMania weekend and, you know, stamped their approval of getting over, it was like, I don't know, for me, I think it was just like, okay, well, I know I've seen better matches than the ones they just put on, but this was like a verification on what they were doing and what the business was, and the fact that, you know, things have changed, and this is something. And that's why I was like, you know, from that point on, it's like, I wish a station like G4 at the time, which was a video game technology station. There was Tech TV and there was G4, and they ended up merging together and Comcast killed them. But like, they would show anime and they would do stuff where it's like, this show would be perfect on that channel. And I thought it was going to go somewhere. Never thought it'd become the second biggest promotion in Japan. Never thought it would have the influence that it did, but I knew it was special. And it was really, that was the really putting the period on the sentence as far as we're in a new time now.
Joe, same question for you.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it, and it had to have been before that first ROH show, which, what was that, 2006?
That was March 2006.
It had to be
before. Shima and Shingo had been over themselves in late 2005, but the big one was March 2006.
Yeah, it had to have been before that, because I remember already being familiar with everybody. But it couldn't have been too much before that, because a lot of the early Toriumon stuff was stuff that I watched after the fact, you know, post-discovery sort of deal. So probably around 2005, I would say.
Yeah, I was the same as that. I was right when I started getting into Japanese wrestling. I'll always bring him up whenever I talk Dragon Gate, but there was a guy on the F4W board called Michael Smith, which when we did when in the early years on the F4W board, there was a Secret Santa gimmick every Christmas, and you'd get someone, you'd have to send them something. And he got me, and he sent me a bunch of Toriumon and I think some early Dragon Gate. And he gave me he did a big write up for me on the meaning behind all the matches and the storylines and this guy and that guy. And I was like, this is really cool. And I threw myself into it and I loved it. And then, yeah, they had the big ROH match, and it was all guns a-blazing from there
they
on.
Had such cool, and I just, they had such cool guys. Because God, now I remember, it's like when we were talking about like this new guy Shingo Takai that was, you know, that was going to come up, but like the openings of the shows were all awesome. Like, and I know,
oh yeah, the Black Crowes, yes, Sting Me one.
Yes, they did the Sting Me one, the original one with the cartoon. It was like, you had the, I mean,
which,
the,
oh, the, you want to, my mind was blown about a month ago when Sarah sat me down and had me watch my first ever episode of was when Joe, when the big Pokemon Go gimmick was doing the rounds. Sarah had me watch the first ever Pokemon regular episode on Netflix, and the intro video was happening, and I was like, holy shit, that's that Dragon Gate intro. It's essentially the Dragon Gate interview was just a ripoff of that. It was all the same.
I didn't even know that.
It was all the same
awesome.
Settings and everything. Yeah. All the same settings, all this, the characters were being used in the same way. It was gas. I was like, oh my god, this is the same thing. But
it was so fun. Yeah. I mean, Lupin the Third. I didn't watch that much anime, but like Lupin the Third, I knew, right? So it's like they had a Lupin character. The Florida Brothers. It's like I know all about Kensuke Sasaki, and now you have these guys like the Florida Brothers. It just Milano.
One
Collection
of the best 18, comedy gimmicks
yeah,
ever.
Milano Collection 18. Now, granted, he, you know, again, talk about a Toriyamon guy, but like him walking the dog and it just Don Fuji, all of these, they just had cool characters. And I know we, you know, especially on the PPH, we focused a lot more obviously on the big guns of New Japan. And, you know, we talked a lot of MMA too, but, you know, Noah and All Japan and things that were going on there, where it's like, boy, in hindsight, like the smart guys like you and Joe Gagné and a lot of other people that, you know, deep.
Joe used it as his entrance theme,
yes,
on
did.
His show.
And it's like, you know, it really, again, when it didn't sink in until they really came over here and got over at those ROH shows, where it's just like, man, this is it.
You know, one of the things I think made it easy for people to kind of get a hold of was the faction thing. And it was something Gabe tried to create in ROH, which, Joe, I'm sure you can speak on, with the faction warfare. Yeah. But I think the way they had it laid out was when they originally came over to America and you had Blood Generation and you had Doofixer, who are Doofixer with his colorful, clearly babyface group, with Dragon Kid being the spectacular, smaller high flyer who was good for getting sympathy, and Blood Generation were just these badass dudes coming out with their weightlifting gimmicks and their red and black. And then you'd have other groups on the periphery, like, I remember Puss Hearts with all the guys wearing all white, Anthony W. Murray, BB Hulk, Super Shisa, and you had Tozawa Juku, which was just one of the most hilarious gimmicks, yes. Which is basically Tozawa's boarding school that he was
always losing.
Always losing, yeah. And then they ended up having two of the guys in that group kind of become serious. Arai and Iwasa became a serious tag team, and they had some incredible Twin Gate tag team matches. But yeah, I think, Joe, what do you think about the stable format for Dragon Gate, and maybe how that kind of provided the ease of access and ease of understanding for people when they discovered the product?
Yeah, because it sorts everybody out immediately. You guys were talking about the openings to Infinity a couple minutes ago, right? Well, remember the one with the Feed the Monster song? Yes. It's that era of Dragon Gate. Not, you know, that they would sort out who was in each unit before the show even started.
Yes,
because they would go through
that.
The entire roster. So if you're a first time viewer or someone who's just trying to catch up, right there, before you even see a wrestling ring, you know who everybody's affiliated with, and you sort of have a framework of who these guys are, instead of trying to jump in to, say, you know, another promotion where it's just it's going to take you longer to figure out what's going on. These guys all have their own little teams. We know what's
color schemes.
Color yeah. schemes are always very important and always a big deal. And so it makes it a lot easier for a new fan jumping in to really sort everything out.
Yeah, you knew who the good guys and the bad guys were. You knew what the comedy. You knew everything right off the bat. That is a fabulous point, because that really did stand out. And again, you can't really. I'm not saying you can't do that today, but there's nobody's been able to match it, and no, I guess nobody's really ever been able to try to match it either. But it is. God, that was a great way to do things.
And you know, it's sort of from a booker's point of view, it would really make your booking easier too. You know, I can imagine sitting in on one of those crazy Raw booking meetings where it's just this blob of a roster and you got to figure out how to, you know, if everyone's broken off into a unit, everyone has a motivation, everyone has an issue with another unit, and it sorts everything out much easier. But the thing is, I'm not sure North American fans, how you'd have to reteach them how to watch wrestling at that point. And I don't know if that's ever going to work, because while Dragon Gate has taken the whole unit thing to an extreme, and, you know, every year or so, every 8 months, they'll reshuffle things, and you come to expect that, units really weren't a foreign concept in Japan. There have always been units to some extent. They're not as stringent about it as Dragon Gate is, but it's not this completely foreign concept. Whereas in the United States, when North American fans think of units, it's always like the Four Horsemen or the NWO. It's always one heel unit that's sort of trying to dominate. It's never an entire roster broken up into units. And I don't think it's worth. And I think that's a lot of where Ring of Honor went wrong. I mean, I know what Gabe had on his mind, but I think a big reason that failed is North American fans just it was too foreign to them. It just didn't work because they weren't taught that as wrestling fans growing up.
That's, I think you would have to retrain them. And Alan, I don't want to jump on you here, but like growing up with Mid-Atlantic, with Jim Crockett Promotions, even though it was a little bit more spread out as far as, like, you know, factions go, you know, I don't know if you guys have heard this or not. This may be new to you guys. Brian Alvarez has been watching old NWA Saturday nights. I don't know if you've heard this or not. It's been a rumor, but it's out there. And like he talks about it. It's like, if you were there at the time, like the Four Horsemen were the big unit, and they were the ones everybody was gunning after. But you had Dusty and Magnum, you had the Midnight Express. Now the Midnight Express had, you know, they had a healthy respect for the Horsemen, but you know there was always the possibility where they could sort of meet up. But like the Dusty and Magnum hated the Midnights. The Midnights were into it with the Rock and Roll Express. We were friends with Dusty and Magnum. But Ricky and Robert were also feuding with the Horsemen. And there was these intertwined things where it was like everybody, again, it's on a smaller scale and it's a little bit different. But that's exactly what they were doing, where it's like it gives you options where the Road Warriors would beat up anybody. You know, the Russians, everybody hated them because they were Russian and they were. There were ways where, again, it was a smaller, more broken up scale, but it was pretty much the same thing. And it gave you the ability to move around and have guys face each other without having to worry too much about, you know, again, like the ridiculous, you know, ways they do things now where it's just everything is so scattershot.
It would have been very interesting if they'd never done it. It would have been way too outside the box, but if they took that faction approach to dividing up the whole roster to one of the brands in the brand split, that would be something which would really set the two. And I think they've done a good job setting the two shows apart since this brand split, but that would have been really something which would have really made them feel different.
If SmackDown, you know what, Alan, that's a great idea on paper, yeah. And it would make the brands have such a different feel from one another. But you and I, we all three of us know, they have no patience, and guys be, you know, where Dragon Gate will milk out a turn over the course of a year to the point where you don't even see it coming. But then when it happens, it all made sense. You know how they're so great at that, where you have no idea the turn's coming, and then it occurs, and then you're like, oh, wait a minute. I should have seen A, B, and C coming all along. Forget it. In that company with weekly TV and the way they hotshot everything, you'd have people turning on each other every week, and then at that point, there's nothing special about it anymore.
You have to establish leaders. You know, there's no managers anymore as far as mouthpieces. There's or at least very few. I mean, nobody that really counts, you know, except for, and Paul doesn't count, and Lana doesn't count. But it's like there's nobody there. Somebody would have to be the top gun for a significant period of time in a stable that they would never let happen because they got an idea for this guy and we need to go here. And that's, yeah, I mean, it can be done. It can be done on a smaller scale. It's just unfortunately not going to happen there for the reasons Joe mentioned. It's just because it's just, this is how Vince is. And then after Vince will come Stephanie, and it is not something that WWE, again, it's not in their mentality to do, because they are, give us three or four guys who are flashy and we can put them on everywhere. And this is what we are, because, you know, we're an entertainment company first and foremost.
All right, guys, I'm going to Sorry, Joe, did you have something you wanted to jump in with there?
Well, the other thing was, you know, Dragon Gate, even though they reshuffle the units, the old stories never die. That's the other thing,
Yeah.
too. Whereas with WWE, every pay-per-view cycle, you're not supposed to remember the previous one for the most part. And Dragon Gate, these old rivalries and these old friendships carry over. Sometimes you'll have
Giving me such a perfect segue here, but continue.
Yeah, you'll have a buddy that's in another unit, or you'll have an enemy that's in your unit. Who were the two Jimmys recently? I think it was Naoki Tanizaki and who was I can't remember.
And Kanes.
Yeah, and they couldn't stand each other, but they were happened to be in the same unit just by happenstance, and that was a
Kanes joined, and Tanizaki was like, fuck, who said this guy could join? I want out now.
Exactly. And these are stories that, you know, this might have been a callback to 2 years previous, and they really, you know, and WWE is never going to have that rich, cohesive, deep connection to the stories, which is also going to make it hard to establish the units.
Okay, this is so perfect, because the question I was going to bring to both you guys is, and I'll go first on this to let you guys have a think, but I just want one match from each of you and myself of a Dragon Gate match to when you think, or it can be Toriumon, when you just think of the promotion, it's the match that really, not the singular match, but one of the matches that really stands out to you as, God, that's so much of what I loved about this promotion. I'm going to go with 2010 Kobe World Show. It was the semi-main event underneath the title match. It was hair versus hair, Shingo Takagi versus BB Hulk. These two, you want to talk about rivalries that will not die. These two guys came through in the dojo. They were the first Dragon Gate Trueborn class, the two of them and Tozawa. But they obviously lapped Tozawa about five times before he even got out of the blocks. And these two, the dynamic was always as far back as one of their first big singles matches at the end of 2005, King of Gate. I'll always remember this. Shingo beating Hulk and standing over him, taunting him, and doing this thing with his hands, which I've seen Shingo do a lot, and I've seen other Japanese wrestlers do it, basically signifying, you're here and I'm here, holding one hand above the other. And he was just holding this out in front of Hulk, and I was like, oh, what a dick. And that's always been the dynamic, and it had always been the dynamic up to this hair match. And this was going to be, it was like, okay, here's where Hulk is, he's gonna really get his own back on Shingo here. But no, it stayed true to how it had been, and it was only in later years that things did kind of switch around and Hulk did get over on Shingo. But here in 2010, it was even more firmly established. Shingo, he's just better. He beat Hulk in one of the most epic matches I've ever seen. So perfect. Every movement made sense. Every movement was deliberate. It was so good. And it just built to such a frantic, amazing finish. And I'll never forget Shingo hitting that final, I don't know if it was the Made in Japan or the Last Falconry. I'd say it was the Last Falconry because it was a big match. And he hit it, and he always lands it in that point where he's got the leg over and he's holding you in the pinfalls. He lands, and as the referee was counting the three, he just saluted up. He just kind of tapped his two fingers on his head and just saluted up. Just the biggest, cockiest dipshit. He was like, yep, he's done. I win. I'm taking his hair. And he was such a dick throughout the whole hair cutting, and Hulk was in tears. That was just epic. And those two, because for me, the first faction that really formed as I was a fan was New Hazard. And that was the one period where these two were on the same side. They had been rivals as younger wrestlers, but now Shingo was back from America, and he was like, who do I want on my side when I'm forming my own unit? The guy I've been fighting up against this whole time. I want BB Hulk on my side. And Yamato was just coming through, so they brought him in as their kind of young protege. They had CyberCon, who was like Shingo's workout buddy, essentially, and then Jack Evans, just because. And New Hazard was, I've still got the t-shirt, the original New Hazard t-shirt, and they were like my faction. So then Shingo and Hulk split up, so that became a rivalry I was invested in, and I always have been to this day. Shingo's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time. Hulk, not so much, but whenever he's in there with Shingo, I'm always interested. And even this year, there was a match in the rather disappointing Summer Adventure Tag League, but the best match of that was the 20-minute draw with Hulk and Yamato against Shingo and Kong. Some great Shingo versus Hulk exchanges in that one. So that would be my pick. Joe, will go to you first. Any match that you want to speak on from Dragon Gate?
I've got two. I'm going to just mention one quickly and then give deeper thoughts on the second. But that four-way 12-man tag team elimination match from last year with the Jimmys, Monster Express, Mad Blanky, and the other team was, I guess, it was when Hulk, Shimizu, what was the name of that unit?
Dia Hearts, yeah.
If you want to talk about just a fun, balls-to-the-wall, go 1,000 miles per hour for an hour straight, you know, Dragon Gate match that a lot of people would hate, but that Dragon Gate fans just love, that would be a match I would point to immediately. But the match I want to talk about, which really – one thing I like to say is when it comes to the big moment, no one does it better than WWE. When it comes to a big match, no one does it better than New Japan. But when it comes to big emotion, Dragon Gate has that locked down. And the one match of recent vintage which really shows that was when Shingo defended the title against Shima after he had run through all of the other veterans. I think this was at the end of last year or early this year. I can't remember.
Final Gate of 2015.
And that match just had so much emotion because you have Shingo, who, in my opinion, is on the run of his career as a heel. I mean, he is just doing a tremendous job. He's my favorite heel in wrestling. He had beaten Gamma. He had beaten Don Fuji. He had beaten Masaki Mochizuki in what was a tremendously emotional match.
Hey, don't steal my thunder on that one.
Okay. I'll leave that one alone. So he has this match against Shima. And down the stretch of this match, Shima calls back to his fallen pals. And he uses all of their signature moves to try to symbolically put Shingo away while using the power and of his pals and his friends. And it still didn't work, and Shingo still came out on top. And that was just – I think that's a match that really exemplifies the emotion of Dragon Gate, because there's no promotion on Earth, there's no promotion that I've ever followed that hits the emotional chord that Dragon Gate hits in a big-time Dragon Gate match.
Their fans fucking love them. And I you know, for you to start with Toriyaman, it was like the joke about Toriyaman and Dragon Gate was – you know, if you were a girl, a teenage girl, or a gay guy, man, you'll love Dragon Gate. You will love these guys. You'll find something in there that you'll love. And it's like, you know, that ended up not really being true. And if it started as being true as a majority of their fans, or not even a majority, but the most notable part of their fans is everything else sucked you in. Because if you're a pro wrestling fan, how could you not like Dragon Gate? For all of the reasons and all the things we had talked about with stables, with callbacks, with action, with everything. And as times, you know, as the business changes, our mentality as fans changed, as different guys got into the business, look what you got. And it's tough. Like with all of the tag matches, there have been so many great tag and six-man and eight-man tag. I don't know. God, I'd have to really kind of sit and think and go through and go, okay, you know, from all the way back, what stands out as my favorites, but just of recent times, that Shingo Mochizuki match was so great. Because here was this,
amazing.
Was this damn near 50-year-old guy that I've seen basically now his whole career. And you know he's not going to win. At least you go into that thinking that, this is part of a story. It's part of a further continuing story that's going on. He's not going to win. And these matches, oh, God, sometimes with Dragon Gate, they go on for too long. I mean, there's the one drawback, in my opinion, sometimes is, and you know what? Doesn't matter what I say, as long as their fans like it and they seem to, great. But it's like, oh, God, you know, some of these things that go on 35, you know, 40 minutes, it's like it's too long. But damn, that was great. The story was great. Everything about it was great. And as you're watching it, for as much if you'd let yourself get involved and they in fact forget about letting you get involved, they just took you into it. You
from
forgot.
The first moment where yes. Mochizuki just goes crazy right out of the bell,
and it's like this motherfucker is throwing everything up against the wall and he throws it all up, and you know what, that young guy, the younger guy, the champion, is able to land the knockout blow, and the old man, it's time, you just came up a little bit short, you threw it all out there. But this young guy was just a half step better, and he beats him. But as it's going on, you forget that this is just a story and that you know how the match is going to end and you know who's going to win. But you forgot because at least I did. Maybe everybody's making fun of me right now for it. But you got so invested in it that those singles matches when they have them like that, and there have been plenty from Dragon Gate, they don't get enough credit. You know, we talk about the New Japan ones, we talk about WWE at Mania, we talk about this, we talk about that. But those Dragon Gate matches, when they're great like that, man, if somebody said that that was their best match of last year, maybe I disagree, but it was certainly up there for me, and I wouldn't shout you down on it. And it's times like that. It's like that more than any time is, you know, that's when they're at their best. You know, as great as the tag match, as great as the stable wars are, and as amazing. Again, Dragon Gate has always amazed me in that how can you move that fast and be that crisp all the time? It's never always perfect. You know, oftentimes, you know, there's going to be, if you wanted to pick nits, you know, you could do it. But I mean, the training that's involved in that, everything that they're able to do, it's just, to me, it's an amazing, amazing promotion. And that was, boy, was that a great match. I loved that match.
Top to bottom, it's the best and most skilled roster in the world, and it has been for years. I will always stand by that, because it's like you said, to work at the pace that they work and to be so close to flawless that they always are. And top to bottom, I mean, you have to go all the way down to like Cyber Kong to find a guy who isn't world class talent wise.
Hey now, watch what you say about my boy.
And you talk to people too, and Alan, I know you have Joe. Assuming that you have, you talk to people that have gone to the dojo, and it's like, and this is, I don't know if you want to use this as a transition now or not, but there is a reason that I never thought I would have said this in 2003, but I'll say it now, that the guy that Chris Jericho dragged out there to face Ernest Miller as Shima Ramalama Ding Dong is on my Hall of Fame ballot, because he deserves a lot of credit for a lot of that. And I know what somebody's going to say. Well, name the how many five-star matches, singles matches has Shima. Doesn't matter. Does not matter one bit. He has been the heart, the soul, the backbone, the face of that promotion. He turned from, you know, the guy with the braids to the guy with the cool glasses and believed what he was doing and made you believe in what he was doing. And I don't know if anybody from this era, Dragon Gate, is going to make it in the Observer Hall of Fame. And I'm not going to make a case for anybody else, but I will make the case for Shima, and I will back up anybody else who's making the case for him, because he deserves to be there.
He may not have the five-star matches, but I'll tell you what, he might have more like 3.5 to 4-star matches than anybody in the world.
It's the Ultimo approach. He's never had, how many bad matches have you ever seen from, and I'm saying like, this is Ultimo before the injury and every WWE and all that stuff, but it's like with Shima, especially even more than Ultimo now, it's like, name a bad match. I defy anybody to do it. I'm sure
you
there's
can.
One.
And with the schedule they run, and even all of those 6-man tags and tag matches, I mean, they're always highly enjoyable matches. I mean, he doesn't even have average matches unless he's in one of those periods where, you know, they cycle guys in and out of the top and he's working
openers.
But
even then, when they took the belt off him after his 2-year-long reign, where he had some epic matches during that reign, but when they took the belt off him and he said himself he was going to cycle down the card and go on the back burner, and he started working second match on the card, European rules matches against Super Shisa, and having these fucking amazing mat wrestling matches where he was just busting out all his old school lucha that he hadn't got to do in years, like the old lucha submission holds. I was like, oh my god, he's so good at that too.
Did you guys happen to see the opener from the latest Korakuen show?
No, I've only just seen the September 29th Korakuen, so I need to see the latest.
I'm stuck back in July. I'm way behind. It's later than that, but I'm too far behind.
I was lucky enough through some sources to get a hold of this show after it aired, and I'll tell you, the opener to that show is Shima, Dragon Kid, and Gamma against 3 young boys, Futa Nakamura and the 2 Watanabe boys. I swear to you guys, that's close to a 4-star match. And I've seen people throw 4 stars at it. Go out of your way to skip ahead, Mike, or Alan, wherever you're at. Skip ahead and at least watch this opener off of this Korakuen show.
Oh, yeah. I'll be watching that show in the next week, I'd say.
I can't wait. I mean, I don't think Shima could help himself. Even when he's not doing something important on the card, he finds a way to have a great match.
He's too charismatic not to. He's the two most charismatic wrestlers I've seen live are Shima and Kenta Kobashi. hands down, don't need to think about any further. They are the two most charismatic live wrestlers. Shima, I saw this guy on, it's got to be in double figures now. I've seen this guy live, and he just orchestrates and conducts an audience from the moment he walks through a curtain. If something goes bad, he saves it. If something like is botched or like if the fucking ring breaks and a turnbuckle falls down or whatever, he'll make it into something that is like a positive. Everything he touches turns to gold, and he can take something that's already shit and touch it and turn it to gold. It's amazing. He's incredible. He's such an incredible performer from the moment he enters to the moment he leaves. He's performing, and he's so goddamn good at it. And Mike, I'll let you make your point, but just to transition to the next thing about him was his influence and how he's been able to take guys like Ricochet and watch Ricochet before Ricochet met Cena, and then watch Ricochet a year after he met Cena, and watch him make an entrance, and you'll see the difference in how he carries himself as a performer before and after Cena. And Ricochet is not the only one, and there'll be more.
No, I mean, well, Pac, and I mean, just any, you know, any of the guys that went through there. And I, you know, it was like Magnum Tokyo was such a, you know, when everything, he was such a big shadowing presence, you know, because of he was him and Milano Collection AT both, you know, they were such characters, you know, and such to me, they were main event characters, you know, and Shima coming along and just took it and raised it and just put it to a different level. I mean, that was just, it blows me away. And I just, Dragon Kid was another guy too, who he seems like he's been around, and I know he's like relatively young. I think he's only like, you know, my age. It's not like he's Mochizuki's age or anything, but
he's hovering around 40.
Yeah.
He might have just entered his 40s or just about to.
It's like he
beat Eddie Guerrero on Nitro.
He's been amazing since like he was like 18. And it blows me away again that these guys have been able to, because we talk about these injuries over and over again. We talk about like Kenta and, you know, in WWE and a lot of the injuries that happen in WWE or in NXT. And it's like, look at what these guys do as Super Bowls. There's no seasons involved in Dragon Gate. You know, they don't take, you know, 4 months off or anything like that. I mean, they seem to be constantly going, yet they're so well trained, and you don't hear about the same sort of injuries. Not to say that they don't get banged up, that serious injuries do happen, but it's like there's got to be something involved in the training there. And Cena being one of the, you know, the main guys in that mix, you know, deserves credit for that too. And the fact that these guys have all been able, for the most part, in general, to continuously be healthy, to pull off the stuff that they're doing.
You know, a huge reason is they don't let you on there if you're not able to go on there and do that and be safe and everyone else be able to work with you. And that goes what Joe was saying about the roster being so high class. It's because if you had 4 or 5 or 6 guys in there who weren't at the level, were a step slower or were just a bit more herky jerky, then
you're breaking
it. The whole machine would fall apart, because if you have 1 or 2 guys who are a step slower, that's where things fall apart and that's where people get hurt. But they make sure that these guys are trained up to a level. Look at these guys that are the 3 guys Joe mentioned in that 6-man tag, and there's about 3 or 4 others. And look at these guys and how crisp and well executed everything they do is, because they are drilled and they do not leave that dojo until they are able to get in and they are able to be a part of that machine without putting anyone at risk. And it's why, hey, he's a great wrestler and he's had a great career and he's going to go on and do great things in NXT. But Roderick Strong lasted 1 tour in Dragon Gate and was never asked back because they viewed him as dangerous. He hurt Naruki Doi and they didn't want him hurting other guys in their roster. You will not last there if they think you will hurt their guys, because they have, especially then, it was a smaller roster and it's a full-time touring roster and they can't afford people getting hurt. Simple as that.
Hey, there's another guy too who fell victim to that, and he's a guy I like and I get along with him and I talk to him from time to time, but Gran Akuma. on the Dragon Gate USA shows. I mean, the big rumor is that that's why he stopped working those shows, because that the Dragon Gate guys didn't want to work with him anymore for those same reasons. So, you know, there's other examples, too.
Well, the phase out, too, and I could be wrong, and Alan, I'll both of you guys, I'll rely on you for that, but like Taro and Judo Suwa, it was like, you know, they had for, you know, they served a purpose, but again, they didn't fit. You know,
Taro's kind of kept out of the way. He would generally just do kind of, he did a lot of the Florida Brothers matches, and he'd be a second at ringside during Shima and Don Fuji matches. Yeah. He was kind of kept out of the way. He didn't really fit. Suwa was a great worker, a really great worker, and he was able to do the style, but it's not, he didn't like the style. He outwardly called it in an interview, I believe, that he did after he left. He referred to it as social dance wrestling, which I believe was a term that a lot of people enjoyed back then. He wanted to go on to different, and it's sad how he ended up, his career panned out with injuries putting paid to him, because he was an incredible talent, but he just viewed wrestling a bit differently than how it was in Dragon Gate. But it's just one of those things that if you don't fit, and if you're putting guys at risk, you're not gonna make it.
And you got to be all in to do that too, because it just, again, with all the neck injuries, all the back injuries, and what these guys are able to do, and it's like, yeah, one false step. You know, how many times have, and granted, it's not as much anymore because we've seen so many spectacular moves, but it's like, you know, I can still remember the first time, you know, and I can't remember, you know, any specifics around it, but I do remember the first time I saw whatever his name was at the time, Dragon Kid, Junior Dragon, whatever they were calling him.
Little Dragon,
like to do that Frankensteiner and to do the flip and come over so fast. And it was like, holy shit. It still blows me away. Even though the moves have gotten even more crazy and more amazing and more cringeworthy in a lot of ways, it's just like, never messed it up once. And that's amazing.
And he's a guy who has had injuries. He's blown out his knee a few times, and he's such a smart worker now that you don't even know that he's banged up.
Yeah,
and he can still go when he has to. I think the two, a lot of things with Dragon Gate is a lot of the bumping is tumbling, which is a lot safer. They, you know, they're not taking a bunch of giant flat back bumps and things like that. It's with the lucha stuff, a lot of it is tumbling. And a point that Rob Viper likes to make all the time with lucha applies to Dragon Gate too. When you're talking about dives to the outside and things like that, that's stuff that looks dangerous but really isn't. Especially in Dragon Gate, because there's always 15 guys standing there to catch
yes.
you. I mean, those guys are never hitting the ground. I mean,
and being a lot lighter helps.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you have these 160-pound, 170-pound men, and they're diving into, and I'm not exaggerating, because the units are out there. So sometimes they're doing these flip dives into a dozen guys. No one's getting hurt.
Yeah, when they do the dive trains and it just builds up, one guy doing a dive, next guy doing a dive, and you gradually have more and more guys being added to the outside by the time Peter Casa does his dive on any of these big tag matches he's in this year, there's like 20 guys catching him. It's hilarious.
Oh, man, yeah, it's great. It's great. And again, you know, we see it in other promotions and other times where it's like large guys doing this. And it's like, well, you can't have it both ways. You can't. How many?
Charlotte doing a dive onto Sasha Banks.
But thank you.
Not a great,
I know.
Not a great idea.
And Charlotte's talking about moonsaulting off the Hell in a Cell onto Sasha Banks. Sasha Ms. Banks is going to catch her.
Yeah.
I mean, Sasha can't. Sasha dove out of the way on that moonsault on Raw a couple of weeks ago in the match with the title change. And the moonsault at WrestleMania was a disaster. And there were two people catching that. Listen. Sasha Banks is 90 pounds soaking wet. You can't have a woman who's twice her size moonsaulting into her. And this
it's ridiculous.
This is where Dragon Gate is so smart about it. So there's a huge difference.
Neville needs to have a word and talk to these people and explain to them how this shit works. But okay, so to bring it back to the Hall of Fame, I think we're all thinking, Mike, I know me and you are very much pro Shima. Joe, I think you would feel he's a strong candidate worthy of a lot of consideration. But I've got an interesting thing to pose to you guys. He's not in the ballot. I don't know when exactly he would get on the ballot. It's probably a little ways down the road. But I don't even know if he'd go on the ballot, because I think people would think of the name and just go, oh, God, no, not a Hall of Famer at all. But I don't know if you noticed, but when we all mentioned our Dragon Gate match sticks out to us, the three matches were all Shingo Takagi singles matches. Shima, Mochizuki, and BB Hulk. I could give you another 10
We didn't plan that, by the way.
Yeah, we did not plan that. I could give you another 10 Shingo Takagi matches right now. Big singles matches that are pretty much the level of the three we mentioned. And I could probably give you 40 that are a level just below that. Never mind all the great tags he's been in. This guy, when I started doing my match of the year tracking lists that people know, and you can see on the voiceofwrestling.com Alan 4L subsection where I just throw random junk that I've collaborated on over the years and just thrown it up there. All my match of the year tracking lists are there. Do a control F and put in Shingo or Takagi. And this guy is good for, I don't know how many, 24 star plus matches pretty much every year since I started doing this thing in 2007. This guy debuted at the end of 2004. In 2005, he was already great. He was the Observer Rookie of the Year in 2005. 2006, he had an injury, but he came back from the injury and did some great things. And did some great things in ROH, especially at the end of his run in early 2007. Shingo Takagi, Joe, you've talked about it when discussing the Hall of Fame, discussing Brian Danielson's candidacy with the three criteria and with the rule being so strong in all or so strong in one that however it's termed, everyone knows.
If you're so overwhelmingly strong in one of the three pieces of criteria, it does state that could make you a candidate, correct?
Yeah. Now, I know not everyone is a fan of the way Shingo wrestles. Some people Dylan Hales.
Who are these people?
Dylan Hales, I'll throw him right out there because I've discussed a Shingo match with him on air, and he made the points of why he didn't like it. They were well made, and I understood them. And there are other people who I'm sure would also not be huge into certain things about Shingo's working style. But for me, and what I like as a wrestling fan, how can I not see Shingo Takagi's name on a ballot in 10 years and not say he is so overwhelmingly strong as an in-ring worker based on this portfolio of matches that this guy has given since 2005 and not say he's a Hall of Famer? I don't know how I can.
I think the only kryptonite, because I think he will be on the ballot. I think there are people that...
Do you? Because I actually don't think Dave would put him on the ballot.
Well, here's
unless
the thing. I think there are enough people that would go... Again, we're going to have to see what the influence is like, too. We're 10 years into Dragon Gate. In another 10 years, you know, whenever it would be when he would go on there, how much influence will he have? It's still to be somewhat determined yet. But as far as the... And I guess you want to throw out there the drawing aspect of it, too. But as far as the body of work goes, I can't see how you couldn't have him on there. He was so great so early. I mean, you look at the Danny Hodge effect, the Kurt Angle effect, the effect of guy great, boom, now. Like was flat out great pretty much right off the bat. And there was somewhat of a curve. And yes, he was great at his own style. But you know what? I don't think in 2016, if you said, hey, Shingo, we want you to wrestle, oh, I don't know, let's go to ROH. Now you're going to wrestle Jay Lethal. And now you're going to go to Evolve and wrestle Matt Riddle. Now you're going to go.
I saw
Cruiserweight Classic.
2009, 16 carat final. He wrestled an FMW match against Drake Younger. I saw it live. I was there. It was nothing at all like he does in Dragon Gate, and it was a 4.5 star match.
You can't deny him as far as that body of work goes. Now I guess the only kryptonite would be somebody, especially that may be a little bit of an older fan going, well, okay, in that case, well, how about Mochizuki or how about Tozawa, you know, but again, I would hesitate to put those two guys on there. You know, Mochizuki maybe, but even him, I would hesitate.
I think Mochizuki deserves a shout on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't hurt my feelings if he was on there. I don't think he'll get in, but I think I can make a hell of a lot easier case for Shingo just because again, it's all right there. It's all right there, and it's all easily accessible. And I think that's going to be the other thing too, where we, as we all talked about earlier on, we all had to fight so much for a lot of these matches and things like that. And, you know, we saw a lot of things, Alan, you know, with LimeWire and stuff like that, like early on that, you know, people had seen for the first time in 05, 06, 07, when they came over and they had the association with Ring of Honor, where, I mean, there are people now, much like we talk about guys being trained in DDT or anywhere else, where it's like, this is their shit. It's not like New Japan and then they gravitated towards this, or they liked All Japan and gravitated towards something. They have been Dragon Gate fans from the start, and there's a lot of them, and they're passionate, and they're not going anywhere, and it has influenced a massive style. So I don't know if I'd vote for him, but I can sure as hell say that he deserves his spot on there, and I would be one of the ones to bark to put him on.
The constant thing about Shingo, though, is people that are in the Japanese culture, Japanese people themselves, and your super hardcore Dragon Gate fans, some of which are on our staff and I talk to on a daily basis about this, they hate the man. And they with the wrong kind of heat, is what I'm saying. Like, you look at Jai, who, of course, covers Dragon Gate Baron A, buddy, you know, he will tell you that Shingo is despised by the Japanese fans in all of the wrong sorts of ways. He's considered to be way more popular among Western fans than he actually is in Japan, and even among the super hardcore Dragon Gate fan. Now,
the anti
exactly. But I have my doubts as to whether that's true, and I have two reasons that I say that. Number one, this has been a very smart promotion that does very smart business, and why would they continually push someone who is legitimately despised by the fan base? And number two, when they do push Shingo, I've posed this question publicly. I've asked people to show it to me. Show me the business decline when this man is on top. Because if he's that despised among the fan base, wouldn't
and the Krez go crazy wanting to see Mochizuki beat him? They want to see Shima beat
him.
Like
those John
matches
Cena.
Have
it sounds like to me the John Cena effect of, like, we hate this guy so much that we're going to pay to watch him.
You know, but they're actually pushing the guy as a
job.
Heel.
I mean, which especially on this heel. Especially on this latest run, which I call the best run of his career. Look, maybe I'll concede that he's not the best babyface, if that's the case, because they always try to push him as a babyface and it just doesn't work at the level they want it to. But as a heel, I'm not buying into this idea that Dragon Gate fans cannot stand the guy and they hate his presence. Show me the business. Look, I'm open-minded to it. If someone can show me a factual business decline when this man is pushed, and they push him, you know, once every couple of years like they do with everybody else, then I'll buy into the idea that the Japanese fans don't like him. Now, if he were to go on the Observer ballot, I'd be very curious to see how, first of all, I don't think he would do well, but I would be very curious to see how he would do among the Japanese voters, because that would really show if there's some legitimacy to this idea that the Japanese fans dislike him.
Well, I mean, I remember that with Kensuke, and a lot. I mean, there were a lot of people that you either liked him or you didn't like him, and a lot of people that didn't like him fucking hated him. And, you know, and that's forget about any other, you know, the dojo thing or any of that stuff. Just personality wise, there are people that either you liked him or you didn't, and he was not. I didn't think he was actually going to get in, and he actually did get in, which actually shocked the shit out of me a couple years ago when he did get in. But it's like, I don't know if it's maybe that sort of thing or what. I don't know. But I think I think if you were to put Shingo on now, today's ballot, yeah, I think he would have problems, because there's a lot of, again, there's a lot of that old school. But I think, again, as years go on and that influence, personality can't play that much of an effect on it. Because, I mean, look at how many people that you might hate that the talent is undeniable. When it gets down to brass tacks, it's like, you know, but then again, it happens in the Baseball Hall of Fame all the time, where personality sometimes for some of these writers really is more than what the skill on the field is or what their attitude is. You know, they have their own personal grudge, but I don't see, I would be stunned if that happens with Shingo. I guess it could.
I can't imagine that Dave's Japanese voting pool is super, not familiar is the word, but I don't know if they're very much entrenched in Dragon Gate. I don't know if they'd separate Shingo from any other guy on the roster that isn't Shima, because I just think Dragon Gate is a very isolated, insular thing. And I'm sure there are people who cover Dragon Gate in Japan that could speak to Shingo as a Hall of Famer, but I can't imagine too many of those people are in Dave's voting base.
I brought up that stereotype earlier on about who the fan base was, and that was rooted in the old school of, again, New Japan and guys who, like you talked about with Sua, of like, this is the anti-lucha, anti that style of like, this is dance choreographed bullshit while we are fighters here, sort of thing.
Here's an interesting one. I was you're gonna drop another name. Oh, maybe I shouldn't drop a name because I remember him telling me not to talk about this conversation, so I won't say who this was. But I was talking to a man who spent a good bit of time wrestling in Japan, and we're talking about 01 and how that's just still afloat and keeps chugging along. And he's like, that's because there's just these essentially rich guys who were big fans in the 90s of Hashimoto or Otani or whoever, and they're still into that, and they're just going to chug a load of money into a 01 to keep it afloat because they just see that as something like Dragon Gate is, oh, that's not really, that's some weird thing on the outskirts. That's not really wrestling. Whereas Dragon Gate is doing so much better business. And if you did have someone like that pumping money into Dragon Gate, imagine what they could do. But instead, Dragon Gate's literally just relying on themselves and what they do. They have no crazy funding coming in. They work hard and get good sponsors and whatnot, for sure. But they don't have just random old fan who's just happens to be rich giving them enough money to keep them their heads above water like 01 do. It's very much on the outskirts. You look at like the Tokyo Sports Awards every year or the different awards, Dragon Gate will get the odd occasional nod here and there.
Just
to give it something, but you know there's no huge consideration being given to Dragon Gate in those awards. I will say though, the is it Weekly Pro, whichever is the magazine that comes out weekly that I think most people would be more familiar with. I have a good few copies of that, and Dragon Gate does get covered in. There's always Dragon Gate stuff in there, to be fair, but I don't know. I can't imagine the voting pool that Dave has in Japan would give Dragon Gate that much credence. I don't for a second think Shingo would ever get in, even if he was put on the ballot. But I'm just saying, if I saw his name on a ballot and I was looking at that criteria of so overwhelmingly strong in one category, I see the portfolio of matches this guy has. And I think if I'm applying the same voting criteria fairly and evenly across the board, I think I'd have to put a tick next to his name. And that's just what he's done up to, I don't know what age he is, 33, 34 at most, I'm sure. Look at what age Mochizuki is right now. Imagine if Shingo goes another 10 years still at this top level.
That's the thing. And then, I think Shingo is smack dab in the middle of his prime right now, or just entering it, really. So
he's the perfect guy to become a grizzled old veteran as well. He's got the right style for it.
And he looks like one. Right. That's why they always push him as a baby. He looks like a dick. You know, it's like
enormous dick. He's a tremendous dick.
He'll be a great old dick too, to say it in a different way, but it's like old lumps, like old Tenru. It's like he just looked like a crusty old motherfucker want to punch you in the face. Shingo's gonna be that too, just on in the Dragon Gate sort of way.
And boy does he have a great crop of young upcoming wrestlers to beat up in 10 years. We were gonna talk a little about those guys and what Dragon Gate need to do to get those guys to the next level and really build their promotion in the next 10 years. We were gonna talk about Katsuyori Shibata's incredible 2016, which is finishing with a murderer's row of matches that this poor guy, whose body is hanging together by tape, he's got to go through some fierce battles before the year is out. And we were going to talk a little about Joe and Mike's memories of the 90s going to ECW. Joe, I know you went to a lot of ECW at the arena, making the trips. Mike, I know you went to various shows in Baltimore from WCW and WWF. We're going to talk about all that stuff. But gentlemen, I think in 2 hours, 15 minutes, we have done a phenomenal job at casting the net out wide across the Japanese pro wrestling landscape and delving off into different topics that branched out from it. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I think it was really good, and I can't wait to do another with you guys in 2017 for sure.
Hey, man, make it a two-parter. I'm ready to talk about all that stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to. Anytime we do it again, I'll just shoehorn. You can have your T-Hawks and the Aiders and all. Give me Lindemann. I love Lindemann.
Hey, Mike, you're in for a treat because Lindemann in the stuff you're about to come into, he's just gone off the deep end.
He's gone
crazy, Joe, hasn't he? Scoring team.
Well, that's
first
right. I did see that. I guess I was far back as I thought because I know about the turn already and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's like
the breakup badly.
I can't remember what the hell. It was a tag match. And I think I forget which one. I'd have to go back and look, but it was awesome. I'll try to find it real quick, but it was just like, I don't know. Those young guys that they have, again, it's like in DDT and in Big Japan, where it's like there are so many good guys, and this is all over the world. There are so many great guys, like under 27, you know, as far as the what should be the real 27 club is this.
Tyler Bate,
you know,
Tyler Bate is going to be the most. Tyler Bate at the Q&A for World Tag League was asked by a fan, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And guess what his answer was? Still in me 20s.
Scary when you think about it.
This dude is already fucking, he's a world beater. He is a world beater already. If he was 4 inches taller, I would say he'd be the WrestleMania main event without a doubt in my mind. He probably won't reach that level because of his height, but he will be in WWE, and he'll be anywhere he wants to go, because I think he might be the most talented young wrestler in the world right now, and there's a lot of them. He was the first name that came to my mind when Mike, you were saying all over the world, and I was thinking UK. Tyler just came into my mind, but there's other ones, and it's across the world, like you said. It's an exciting time. If the industry can just do the right things by this crop of wrestlers that are coming up, and if these guys can keep their heads screwed on and move in the right direction, and if we have the veterans that are there to support, the infrastructure there to bring these guys along, more Chris Heroes and people like that to mentor these guys, the wrestling industry is poised for a really exciting next decade if things click. It really is.
Takeshita, Endo, so much. There's so many guys, and it was Ida and Lindemann against the Jimmies in January, actually, where it was just like the match was not super special or anything like that, but it was just like a Dragon Gate take on an American tag match from the 80s, and it was just. I thought it was great, and it required less suspension of disbelief than some Dragon Gate matches will. I mean, it just was it was awesome, and I think it was I can't remember. I think it was Susumu was like a sunset flip, and oh god, what was it? It was Susumu with the sunset flip on Saito. I think he did a German suplex on Ada, and it was awesome, and I just think it was like okay. Again, Lindemann, I'm sold. You know, there was a lot of talk with T-Hawk and Ada, but it's like, that's the dude I'm sold on the most.
And Dragon Gate keeps pumping him out, because let me tell you something. This grumpy prick Shingo that we're talking about, who's going to be a grumpy prick into his late 30s, is going to be fending off that Futa Nakamura, because that Futa Nakamura is the absolute business. That guy has superstar written all over him. I can't wait for you guys to die. Have you seen a lot of him yet, Alan?
Oh, yeah. The coolest thing I saw in one of the recent shows was that Lindemann had this freak out of all freakouts, and he was against one of the young boys, and he beat the shit out of them and beat them. And then after Bell, he was beating them up more. And then the other young boys came to kind of like break it up. And Lindemann was throwing his big fit, and then Futa Nakamura just stands right up to him, and the camera zooms in, and Lindemann's expression changes, and he's like, oh, I'm just going to back out of this situation slowly. And Futa is just staring at him. And you know when I first saw Futa Nakamura, guys?
Where?
When he took my ticket when I went into Dragon Gate at Cork and all.
Get out of here.
Let me tell you something. That little moment you described with Lindemann, That's not an accident. And neither, when you guys watched this Korakuen show that just went down, that opener, which there's a moment between Futa Nakamura and Shima, which is also not an accident. They know what they have in this guy. And he's still in the black compression shorts part of his career. And they already know that this guy has that it. That you just it's not quantifiable. You can't put your fit. It's just that thing that certain guys have, and they know it already with him because they keep giving him these little moments and planting seeds. So yeah,
he only debuted. He only debuted during the summer. He's still brand new.
Yes, but I mean, there's just something about him. He just jumps off the screen a lot like Higuchi in DDT.
Oh god, if we start talking to Higuchi now, we'll be here another hour.
Have you seen Nomura from Big Japan?
Nomura's incredible. Fuck, now we've so many great rookies in Japan, we've got multiple Nomuras that are really good. I was still getting my head around how good the All Japan Nomura was, and now we've got a Big Japan Nomura who's even better. It's crazy. All right, we'll call it a day there, guys. Thank you so much. Let's get some plugs in, because obviously both of you guys do a ton of great work. Joe, tell everyone about Voice of Wrestling and what you guys are doing.
VoicesOfWrestling.com is the website. We review shows from around the world. We have columns. We have opinions. We have all kinds of stuff going on the front page. We have a great forum that I think a lot of people who would listen to this type of podcast would really enjoy. We've got threads for every major promotion and minor promotion really in the world. There's an Australian wrestling thread on our forum where people are breaking down Australian wrestling. There's a New Zealand wrestling thread. Anything you want to talk about, we've got a thread.
I need to watch that Ronald McDonald match.
Let me tell you something. Both of you guys need to watch. I'm not even kidding. Those Ronald McDonald matches from Australia, and people think we're nuts right now. But you carve out the time. Carve out 15 minutes for those matches.
I've got it set to watch on my YouTube watch later. It's just this weekend I'll get to it.
There you go. And then, of course, the Voices of Wrestling flagship podcast, myself and Rich Kreach, every week breaking down the world of wrestling, 3 hours. We go into some very zany areas like we did this past week. And then, of course, we have an entire podcast network, Shake Them Ropes. Open the Voice Gate if you enjoyed the Dragon Gate talk here. Brit Wrestling Roundtable. We've got the New Japan Pearl cast. All of our podcasts are different. The Lucha of the Hidden Temple, which is the Lucha Underground podcast. The WrestleNomics with Mookie Ghana. So, and I'm probably forgetting a podcast and the person's going to kill me. But all of our podcasts in our network are different. You're not going to hear 8 different Monday Night Raw breakdowns every week. Every show you listen to is going to have completely different content. So give our podcast a shot as well.
Mike?
Kazusada Higuchi. I just got him, man. I love him. He's just like an old guy brought to life in this era. It's just amazing. But anyway, yeah, Joe Gagne somewhere smiling that I would ever talk about DDT or this much. But you know what I do with Brian Alvarez every single day, Wrestling Observer Live, Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. live Eastern Daylight Time right now. Sunday, the Mothership, 6 p.m. when that's available on Sirius XM. The other shows are available. Just go to the website, WrestlingObserver.com, to the front page at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, and you'll find out how to listen to it. It's available through TuneIn and lots of other ways. You know, when Brian is not available on the show and I'm doing solo shows, I always like to kind of throw that out there to anybody listening. You don't want to talk about something a little bit different, like Japan, like anything else, Rev Pro, I don't care what it is, please, you know, let me know, drop me the line, because, again, I like talking about different things. I like doing different things on that program. And, you know, for the most part, you got to stick with what people want to talk about and the big news of the day and everything. But, Alan, like, you know, I've been trying to push that show when I'm on it in a lot of different directions and a lot different than what you usually hear. But I love doing it. I love having the opportunity to do it. And I wouldn't have been able to get there if it wasn't for the show that I do with Adam Summers. Every once in a while and again, I thank both of you for doing shows that fill people in on Japan, because Adam and I can't do shows like we used to do. We just don't have the time to do them on both sides, which is tough. But there have been other people that have been able to fill it in. But when we do a show, I'd love for you to listen. The Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare, the extension, the true extension of the PPH, us and Alan with the DKP. hey, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not going to say anything about anybody else, I love everybody, but, you know, you wouldn't be here without us, period. And I'll have enough of my own ego to say that one, because when there was nothing happening in Japan, and before there was nothing happening in Japan, we were there to cover it, and we hopefully provided an influence, and I know we did. So don't forget about the original alternate at F4WOnline.com when you see it pop up there. But Alan, I want to thank you, and Joe, I want to thank you for doing this too.
Joe plugs the flagship. Mike plugged the mothership. I just got my great friendships that I forged with you guys, and I'm so happy that you're here.
What a hack. Awful.
God, man, you talked about that shaky boat show. You ever, Jeff Hawkins, you ever seen him in a turtleneck? Looks just like a penis.
He really does. He wore a turtleneck in Dallas, I think, when I met up with him. So, yeah, you're right. He does look like a penis. Now we'll find out if he listened to this whole thing, because
that's why I'm throwing it out there. Just
nice Easter egg.
Well, he doesn't have to be a member to do so, because I'm making this a free show. It was that damn good. I just hope the servers contain the mighty 2 hours, 29 minutes, as it's about to tick into, of this show.
Hey, look, as long as I'm not recording it, it'll probably be fine.
Thank you all for listening. We'll be back here on the DKP soon. Mike, thank you. Joe, thank you. This is a blast. Thank you, guys. Bye, everyone.
Yeah.